Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
This is KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Maureen Cavanaugh. A San Diego writer is now the best-selling author for young adults. Tomi Adeyemi is just 24, but her first book, Children of Blood and Bone, is a major hit and is already being adapted into a movie series. The novel is the first in a trilogy set in a world with magic, inspired by Adeyemi's Nigerian heritage. Adeyemi talked about her book with Midday Edition producer Michael Lipkin.
Tomi, describe the world of Children of Blood and Bone.
Yeah, so it's basically Black Panther, but with magic. So where Black Panther was this sci-fi reimagining of Africa, Children of Blood and Bone takes that, but with a magical spin. So we have, you know, these epic jungles and deserts. We have these giant, like, magical lions. And it's based off my Nigerian heritage. So all the cities are named after real Nigerian cities. And, yeah, it's just the celebration of both Nigerian and West African culture.
It's a common theme in a lot of fantasy books where magic gets lost, which is what happens in this world, and then someone has to go on a journey to bring it back.
Yeah.
Why did you choose that structure? Is there something you see in the real world as lost?
When I started with the idea of magic being lost, I had read another fantasy that took place in a world where there had been magic and there was no magic anymore. And it wasn't explored at all. And I was like, why are we running around this castle? Like, you're not playing with the economics of the world you've set up. So I was just like, you wasted it, so I need to fix it. So that's where it started. But then this book also became like my way to talk about what was going on in the world and police brutality and really getting to, I guess, dive deep into that in a way I don't think people talk about a lot, because we know, like, we know the phrase Black Lives Matter, we know the hashtags, we know the videos, but it's like we don't talk about the emotional toll of that and the emotional toll of that when you are the survivor and you're the person seeing people who look like you get gunned down by the police. And so that, I thought that was another story, and my boyfriend was like, I think it's the same story. So then all of those things were working in. It starts one way, but then there's all these added layers. So then when I came back to this idea of magic being lost, I was like, oh, wow, that's kind of like when you grow up as a marginalized person and, you know, the world is like unicorns and rainbows and jelly beans. And then one day you see that person on the baseball field, that white parent yelling at your little or your older brother at the time and, you know, calling him the N-word. And you're like, what's going on? And like one day everyone has it. They have that experience where they realize like, oh, I'm different. And because I'm different, things are going to be harder for me. Because I'm different, people are going to hate me. And it's kind of like going from that magical world to this period of black and white. And it's really hard. You see, you have all this beautiful thing. Like Zaylee's childhood is a really happy childhood. And there's still bad things that happen. It's not perfect, but it's a beautiful place. And that's ripped away really violently. And I feel like that's actually what happens to a lot of marginalized people every day.
Speaking of violence, there are a number of scenes of violence in the book, which you have taken kind of from real world incidents and sort of put them in this magical world. Why was it important to you to put those incidences of violence, police violence, in a fantasy setting opposed to a more modern setting?
Whenever we interact with something in this world, we come with all of our prejudices and And those are things that are really hard to unlearn and really hard to pick apart because they're always on. So they're always these lenses with which you're interpreting everything you see. Whereas when you go in a fantasy world, this is a brand new world. And like the rules are very clearly laid out for you in black and white. So you can see, I can show you the same video of like a 17-year-old girl in Florida being thrown down to the ground by police officers. And I can show you that scene in the book. And in the book, it's going to be very hard for someone to be like, well, actually, all lives matter. You're like, no. You're like, this is wrong. This person didn't do anything. This person is a child. And this is an authority figure abusing power and abusing a child, physically abusing a child. For me, it was about being able to show that and then take the lens off and have people go, oh. And I've seen even one person, they're like, this is going to sound dumb, but I didn't realize how bad things still were. And it's kind of, I guess, easy if you're not looking for it, you know, whereas for me, it's like I can't go 1 hour on Twitter without finding out about another black person who's been shot or seeing a black person who jaywalked and got tased by a police. Like, this is constant. This is my day to day. But if you're not following those things, if you're not looking for it, you might not know it. So it was important for me to show it in the book and not be gratuitous with it, because even the most violent parts of the book are still based off real things. And actually worse things. Showing that, I think, it's a conversation starter. And it's a way to get through to people without all those preconceived notions.
Your book, Children of Blood and Bone, is coming out in a moment when art about black culture by black artists is enormously popular. There's Black Panther is the highest grossing movie of all time, pretty much. A Wrinkle in Time has seen a lot of success.
Yeah.
What do you think is different about this moment?
It's funny, too, because people were like, did you plan this? And I was like, no, books take years. So we didn't know Black Panther was going to come out 2 weeks beforehand. We didn't know it was going to be the highest grossing movie, like, basically all time. But I think there were other signs of the shift. Like, for me, I remember it was 2 months before I left my job, the news about The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas broke. And about how like 13 publishing houses had fought over it. And then, you know, Fox and Temple were making it into a movie. And like that was kind of unheard of success, but also super unheard of for a black author writing a story about black people with a black protagonist about being black. I was like, that was unheard of. But it doesn't come out of nowhere. It's not the first time a story like that's been written. So I think for a lot of people, it seems like Black Panther, Wrinkle in Time, Children of Blood and Bone, The Hate U Give. But it's like we've been making movies, we've been writing stories. It's just people haven't been paying attention.
What I find really interesting about your success that you've had at such a young age is that you said that you initially tried to fight being a writer, that you did not want to pursue that as a career. And here you are, 24. You have an incredible book deal. It's going to be turned into a movie. Why were you fighting that impulse at first?
It's still scary. And I don't even think it's just like being a writer, creative. It's like whenever you want to do something and you really want to do it with all your heart and you're like, this is really what I want to do every day for the rest of my life, it is scary to acknowledge that, because if you acknowledge that, then you have to go for it. And if you don't go for it, then you're miserable. You can't go back to, okay, I know I want to be a writer, but I'm happy uploading ads to Twitter instead. You know, so for me, it was like the longer I lied to myself, the more I could delay that sort of inevitable choice of like, okay, now you know what you want. Do you go for it? Do you sit down? But yeah, eventually, by the time it was around maybe 6 months of working my post-college job, I was just like, okay, I am more miserable here than I am afraid of trying to be a writer. So I'm going to try and be a writer. I have that conversation with a lot of people, not just people who want to be authors. I was like, don't lie to yourself, because you can only lie to yourself for so long. And so for me, it was like 21 years.
That was San Diego author Tomi Adeyemi speaking with producer Michael Lipkin. Her debut novel is Children of Blood and Bone.
Context of White Supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, April 27th, 2018. So I have been told. This is our eighth and final study session on Angie Thomas's The Hate U Give. We are all done this week. We will wrap things up. Thank goodness. So glad to be done with this book. I hope we are lucky enough to have some young folks, black children who've read the book, dial in. They can share about their experience or thoughts on the text. And then if we have any older folks, victims, who read the book and actually enjoyed Ms. Thomas's work, definitely would enjoy hearing your perspective as well. Maybe we just, you know, missed a few important points over the past couple of months. Looking forward to hearing concluding thoughts, perspectives. What did we learn over the past few weeks reading one of the most popular young adult novels in the history of the United States? Also, the audio clip that we started with, Tomi Adeyemi, black female author, she had the top young adult bestseller a few weeks ago. She had supplanted The Hate U Give, her book, Children of Blood and Bone, which I do not think has all of the same Negro stereotypes, drug-selling, thug, gun-toting black dudes and ratchet black people who can't, you know, control themselves and are just running around having sexual intercourse willy-nilly and having children with every possible body in the world. It doesn't have all those stereotypes. I don't think it has all the profanity and what have you either. I don't know if that got as much attention as you heard they're going to be making it into a major feature film, but I'd just be curious if anyone had heard of that text, is reading that text, just seeing as how it seemed many of our listeners were very aware of The Hate U Give. With that, we will go ahead and get started. We're picking up on chapter 24, the final installment, Angie Thomas, The Hate U Give, Context of White Supremacy.
24. Because Seven said we'd be all right, everything goes wrong. Most of the routes through the east side are blocked off by police, and it takes Seven forever to find one that isn't. About halfway to the store, the car grunts and slows down. Come on, Seven says. He rubs the dashboard and pumps the gas. Come on, baby. His baby basically says, fuck it, and stops. Shit! Seven rests his head on the steering wheel. We're out of gas. You're kidding, right? Chris says. I wish, man. It was low when we left your house, but I thought I could wait a while before I got gas. I know my car.
You obviously don't know shit, I say. We're next to some duplex houses. I don't know what street this is. I'm not familiar with the east side like that. Sirens go off nearby, and it's as hazy and smoky as the rest of the neighborhood.
There's a gas station not too far from here, Seven says. Chris, can you help me push it?
As in, get out the protection of this car and push it? Chris asks.
Yeah, that. It'll be all right. Seven hops out.
That's what you said before, Chris mumbles, but he climbs out.
Devante says, I can push too. Nah, man, you need to rest up, says Seven. Just sit back, Star, get behind the wheel.
This is the first time he's ever let anyone else drive his baby. He tells me to put the car in neutral and guide it with the steering wheel. He pushes next to me. Chris pushes on the passenger side. He constantly glances over his shoulder. The sirens get louder and the smoke thickens. Seven and Chris cough and cover their noses with their shirts. A pickup truck full of mattresses and people speeds by. We reach a slight hill, and Seven and Chris jog to keep up with the car.
Slow down, slow down, Seven yells.
I pump the brakes. The car stops at the bottom of the hill. Seven coughs into his shirt.
Hold on, I need a minute.
I put the car in park. Chris bends over, trying to catch his breath.
The smoke is killing me, he says.
Seven straightens up and slowly blows air out his mouth.
Shit. We'll get to the gas station faster if we leave the car. The two of us can't push it all the way.
The hell? I'm sitting right here. I can push.
I know that star. Even if you did, we'll still be faster without it. Damn. I don't want to leave it here, though. How about we split up? Chris says. Two of us stay here, and two of us go get some gas. And this is that white people shit you guys were talking about, isn't it? Yes, the rest of us say. Told you, says Devante. Seven folds his hands and rests them on top of his dreads. Fuck, fuck, fuck! We gotta leave it. I get Seven's keys, and he grabs a gas can from the trunk. He caresses the car and whispers something to it. I think he says he loves it and promises to come back. Lord. The four of us start down the sidewalk and pull our shirts over our mouths and noses. Devante limps but swears he's all right. A voice in the distance says something I can't make out, and there's a thunderous response, like from a crowd. Chris and I walk behind the other two. His hand falls to his side, and he brushes up against me, his sly way of trying to hold my hand. I let him. So this is where you used to live? He says. I forgot this is his first time in Garden Heights. Yeah, well, not this side of the neighborhood. I'm from the west side. West side? Seven says, as Devante throws up a W. The best side! On my mama, Devante adds. I roll my eyes. People go too far with that what side of the neighborhood you from mess. You saw that big apartment complex we passed? Those are the projects we lived in when I was younger. Chris nods. That place where we parked? Was that the Taco Bell your dad took you and Seven to? Yeah, they opened a new one closer to the freeway a few years ago. Maybe we can go there one day, he says. Bruh, Devante butts in. Please tell me you ain't considering taking your girl to Taco Bell for a date. Taco Bell? Seven hollers laughing. Excuse me, was anybody talking to y'all? I ask. Hey, you my friend, I'm trying to help you out, says Devante. Your boy ain't got no game. I have game, Chris says. I'm letting my girl know I'm happy to go with her anywhere, no matter what neighborhood it's in. As long as she's there, I'm good. He smiles at me without showing his teeth. I do too. Psh, it's still Taco Bell, says Devante. By the end of the night, it'll be Taco Hell with them bubble guts. The voice is a bit louder now, not clear yet. A man and a woman run by on the sidewalk, pushing two shopping carts with flat-screen TVs in them. They wildin' out here, Devante says with a chuckle, but grabs his side. King kicked you, didn't he? Seven says, with those big-ass Tims on, right? Devante whistles a breath out. He nods. Yeah. He did that to my mama once. Broke most of her ribs. A Rottweiler on a leash in a fenced-in yard barks and struggles to come after us. I stomp my foot at it. It squeals and jumps back. She's all right, Seven says, though it seems like he's trying to convince himself. Yeah, she's fine. A block away, people stand around in a four-way intersection, watching something on one of the other streets.
You need to exit the street,
a voice announces from a loudspeaker.
You are unlawfully blocking traffic.
A hairbrush is not a gun. A hairbrush is not a gun, a voice chants from another loudspeaker. It's echoed back by a crowd. We get to the intersection. A red, green, and yellow school bus is parked on the street to our right. It says, Just Us for Justice, on the side. A large crowd is gathered in the street to our left. They point black hairbrushes into the air. The protesters are on Carnation, where it happened. I haven't been back here since that night, knowing this is where Khalil... I stare too hard. The crowd disappears. and I see him lying in the street. The whole thing plays out before my eyes like a horror movie on repeat. He looks at me for the last time and...
A hairbrush is not a gun!
The voice snaps me from my daze. Ahead of the crowd, a lady with twists stands on top of a police car, holding a bullhorn. She turns toward us, her fist raised for black power. Khalil smiles on the front of her t-shirt.
Ain't that your attorney, Star?
Seven asks.
Yeah.
Now, I knew Miss Ofra was about that radical life, but when you think attorney, you don't really think person standing on a police car with a bullhorn, you know?
Disperse immediately,
the officer repeats. I can't see him for the crowd. Miss Ofra leads the chant again.
A hairbrush is not a gun. A hairbrush is not a gun.
It's contagious and echoes all around us. Seven, Devante, and Chris join in. A hairbrush is not a gun, I mutter. Khalil drops it into the side of the door. A hairbrush is not a gun. He opens the door to ask if I'm okay. Then pow, pow.
A hairbrush is not a gun!
I scream loud as I can, fist high in the air, tears in my eyes.
I'm going to invite Sister Freeman to come up and give a word about the injustice that took place tonight, Miss Ofra says.
She hands the bullhorn to a lady who's also in a Khalil shirt, and she hops off the patrol car. The crowd lets her through, and Miss Ofra heads toward another co-worker who's standing near the bus at the intersection. She spots me and does a double take.
Star, she says, making her way over. What are you doing out here?
When they announced the decision, I wanted to do something. So we came to the neighborhood. She eyes beat up Devante.
Oh my God, did you get caught in the riots?
Devante touches his face.
Damn, I look that bad?
That's not why he looks like that, I tell her. But we did get caught in the riots on Magnolia. It got crazy over there. Looters took over.
Miss Ofra purses her lips.
Yeah, we heard. Just Us for Justice was fine when we left, Seven says.
Even if it's not, it's okay, says Miss Ofra. You can destroy wood and brick, but you can't destroy a movement. Star, does your mother know you're out here?
Yeah. Don't even sound convincing to myself.
Really?
Okay, no. Please don't tell her.
I have to, she says. As your attorney, I have to do what's in your best interest. Your mom, knowing you're out here, is in your best interest.
No, it's not, 'cause she'll kill me. But you're my attorney, not hers. Can't this be a client confidentiality thing?
Star.
Please? During the other protests, I watched and talked. So now I want to do something.
Who said talking isn't doing something? She says. It's more productive than silence. Remember what I told you about your voice?
You said it's my biggest weapon.
And I mean that.
She stares at me a second, then sighs out her nose.
You want to fight the system tonight?
I nod.
Come on, then.
Miss Ofra takes my hand and leads me through the crowd.
Fire me, she says.
Huh?
Tell me you no longer want me to represent you.
I no longer want you to represent me? I ask.
Good. As of now, I'm not your attorney, so if your parents find out about this, I didn't do it as your attorney, but as an activist. You saw that bus near the intersection?
Yeah.
If the officers react, run straight to it. Got it?
But what? She takes me to the patrol car and motions at her colleague. The lady climbs off and hands Miss Ofra the bullhorn. Miss Ofra passes it over to me.
Use your weapon, she says.
Another one of her co-workers lifts me and sets me on top of the cop car. About 10 feet away, there's a shrine for Khalil in the middle of the street. Lit candles, teddy bears, framed pictures, and balloons. It separates the protesters from a cluster of officers in riot gear. It's not nearly as many cops as it was on Magnolia, but still, they're cops. I turn toward the crowd. They watch me expectantly. The bullhorn is as heavy as a gun. Ironic, since Miss Ofra said to use my weapon. I have the hardest time lifting it. Shit. I have no idea what to say. I put it near my mouth and press the button. It makes a loud, ear-splitting noise. Don't be scared, somebody in the crowd yells. Speak!
You need to exit the street immediately, the cop says.
You know what? Fuck it.
My name is Star. I'm the one who saw what happened to Khalil, I say into the bullhorn. And it wasn't right.
I get a bunch of yes and amens from the crowd.
We weren't doing anything wrong. Not only did Officer Cruz assume we were up to no good, he assumed we were criminals. Well, Officer Cruz is the criminal.
The crowd cheers and claps. Miss Ofra says, speak. That amps me up. I turn to the cops.
I'm sick of this. Just like y'all think all of us are bad because of some people, we think the same about y'all. Until you give us a reason to think otherwise, we'll keep protesting.
More cheers. And I can't lie, it eggs me on. Forget trigger happy. Speaker happy is more my thing.
Everybody wants to talk about how Khalil died, I say. But this isn't about how Khalil died. It's about the fact that he lived. His life mattered. Khalil lived.
I look at the cops again.
You hear me? Khalil lived.
You have until the count of three to disperse,
the officer on the loudspeaker says.
Khalil lived, we chant.
One.
Khalil lived.
Two.
Khalil lived.
Three.
Khalil lived.
The can of tear gas sails toward us from the cops. It lands beside the patrol car. I jump off and pick up the can. Smoke whizzes out the end of it. Any second, it'll combust. I scream at the top of my lungs, hoping Khalil hears me, and chuck it back at the cops. It explodes and consumes them in a cloud of tear gas. All hell breaks loose. The cops stampede over Khalil's shrine, and the crowd runs. Someone grabs my arm, Ms. Ofra.
Go to the bus, she says.
I get about halfway there when Chris and Seven catch me.
Come on,
Seven says, and they pull me with them. I try to tell them about the bus, but explosions go off and thick white smoke engulfs us. My nose and throat burn as if I swallowed fire. My eyes feel like flames lick them. Something whizzes overhead. Then an explosion goes off in front of us. More smoke.
Devante,
Chris croaks, looking around.
Devante!
We find him leaning against a flickering streetlight. He coughs and heaves. Seven lets me go and grabs him by the arm.
Shit, man, my eyes. I can't breathe.
We run. Chris grips my hand as tight as I grip his. There are screams and loud pops in every direction. Can't see a thing for the smoke. Not even the Just Us bus.
I can't run. My side, Devante says. Shit.
Come on, man, Seven says, pulling him. Keep going.
Bright lights barrel down the street through the smoke. A gray pickup truck on oversized wheels. It stops beside us, the window rolls down, and my heart stops, waiting for the gun to come pointing out,
courtesy of a king lord. But Goon, the Cedar Grove king lord with the ponytails, looks at us from the driver's seat, a gray bandana over his nose and mouth.
Get in the back, he says.
Two guys and a girl around our age, wearing white bandanas on their faces, help us into the back of the truck. It's an open invitation and other people climb in, like this white man in a shirt and tie and a Latino holding a camera on his shoulder. The white man looks oddly familiar. Goon drives off. Devante lies in the bed of the truck. He holds his eyes and rolls in agony.
Shit, man. Shit.
Bree, get him some milk, Goon says through the back window.
Milk?
We're out, Unc, says the girl in the bandana.
Fuck,
Goon hisses. Hold on, Vante. Tears and snot drip down my face. My eyes are damn near numb from burning. The truck slows down.
Get little homie, Goon says.
The two guys in the bandanas grab some kid on the street by his arms and lift him into the truck. The kid looks around 13. His shirt is covered in soot, and he coughs and heaves. I get into a coughing fit. Snorting is like hacking up hot coals. The man in the shirt and tie hands me his dampened handkerchief.
It'll help some, he says. Put it against your nose and breathe through it.
It gives me a small amount of clean air. I pass it to Chris. He uses it. Passes it to Seven beside him. Seven uses it and passes it to someone else.
As you can see, Jim, the man says, looking at the camera, there are a lot of youth out here protesting tonight, black and white.
I'm the token, huh? Chris mutters to me before coughing. I'd laugh if it didn't hurt.
And you have people like this gentleman going around the neighborhood, helping out where they can, the white man says. Driver, what's your name?
The Latino turns the camera toward Goon.
Nunya, Goon says. Thank you, Nunya, for giving us a ride.
Wow. I realize why he looks familiar, though. He's a national news anchor. Brian somebody.
This young lady here made a powerful statement earlier, he says, and the camera points toward me. Are you really the witness?
I nod. No point hiding anymore.
We caught what you said back there. Anything else you'd like to add for our viewers?
Yeah.
None of this makes sense.
I start coughing again. He leaves me alone. When my eyes aren't closed, I see what my neighborhood has become. More tanks, more cops in riot gear, more smoke. Businesses ransacked. Streetlights are out, and fires keep everything from being in complete darkness. People run out of the Walmart and carry armfuls of items, looking like ants rushing from an anthill. The untouched businesses have boarded up windows and graffiti that says, Black Owned. We eventually turn onto Marigold Avenue. And even with the fire in my lungs, I take a deep breath. Our store is in one piece. The windows are boarded up with that same black-owned tag on them, like it's lamb's blood protecting the store from the plague of death. The street is pretty still. Top Shelf Spirits and Wine is the only business with broken windows. It doesn't have a black-owned tag either. Goon stops in front of our store. He jumps out, comes to the back of the truck, and helps everyone out.
Star, Sev, y'all got a key?
I pat my pockets for Seven's keys and toss them to Goon. He tries each key until one unlocks the door.
In here, y'all, he says.
Everyone, including the cameraman and reporter, go in the store. Goon and one of the guys in the bandana get Devante and carry him inside. No sign of Daddy. I crawl onto the floor and fall on my stomach, blinking fast. My eyes burn and fill with tears. Goon sets Devante on the old people's bench before running toward the refrigerator. He rushes back with a gallon of milk and pours it into Devante's face. The milk momentarily turns him white. Devante coughs and sputters. Goon pours more.
Stop, Devante says. You about to drown me. I bet your eyes ain't hurt no more, though, Goon replies.
I half crawl, half run to the refrigerators and get a gallon for myself. I pour it on my face. The relief comes in seconds. People pour milk onto their faces while the cameraman records it all. An older lady drinks from a gallon. Milk pools on the floor, and a college-aged guy lies face down in it and gasps for air. When people get the relief they need, they leave. Goon grabs a bunch of cartons of milk and asks,
Hey, can we take this in case somebody needs it on the street?
Seven nods and sips from a carton.
Thanks, little homie. If I see your pops again, I'll tell him y'all here.
You saw our... I cough and sip some milk, dousing the flames in my lungs. You saw our dad?
Yeah, a little while ago. He was looking for y'all.
Oh, shit. Sir, the reporter says to Goon, can we ride along? We'd like to see more of the neighborhood.
Ain't no thing, homie. Hop in the back.
He turns to the camera and twists his fingers so they resemble a K and an L.
See the Grove Kings, baby. Crowns up. Adio.
He gives the King Lord call. Leave it to Goon to throw gang signs on live TV. They leave us alone in the store. Seven, Chris, and I are in the pool of milk with our knees up to our chests. Devante's arms and legs dangle off the old people's bench. He chugs back some milk. Seven takes his phone from his pocket.
Damn, my phone's dead. Star, you got yours?
Yeah, I have way too many voicemails and way too many texts, most of them from Mama. I play the voicemails first. They start out safe enough with Mama saying, Star, baby, call me as soon as you get this, okay? But they soon become, Star, Amara, I know you're getting these messages. Call me. I'm not playing. They progress to, See, you've taken this too far. Carlos and I are heading out the door right now, and you better pray to God we don't find you. And on the last message left a few minutes ago, Mama says, Oh, so you can't return my calls, but you can lead protests, huh? Mama told me she saw you on live TV giving speeches and throwing tear gas at cops. I swear I'm gonna snatch your life if you don't call me.
We in deep shit, man, Devante says. Deep shit.
Seven glances at his watch.
Damn, we been gone about 4 hours. Deep shit, Devante repeats. Maybe the four of us can get a place in Mexico, says Chris.
I shake my head. Not far enough for our mom. Seven picks at his face. The milk has dried and formed a crust.
All right, we need to call them. And if we call from the office phone, Ma will see it on the caller ID and know we're not lying when we say we're here. That'll help, right?
We're at least 3 hours too late for any help, I say. Seven stands and gives me and Chris a hand up. He helps Devante off the bench.
Come on, make sure y'all sound remorseful, all right?
We head for Daddy's office. The front door creaks. Something thuds onto the floor. I turn around. A glass bottle with flaming cloth.
Woof!
The store is suddenly lit bright orange. A heat wave hits like the sun dropped in. Flames lick the ceiling and block the door. 25. An entire aisle is already engulfed.
The back door, Seven says, choked up. The back door!
Chris and Devante follow us down the narrow hall near Daddy's office. It leads to the restroom and the back door where deliveries are unloaded. Smoke's already filling the hall. Seven pushes the door. It doesn't budge. He and Chris ram their shoulders against it, but it's bulletproof, shoulder-proof, everything-proof. The burglar bars won't let us out anyway.
Star, my keys, Seven croaks,
I shake my head. I gave them to Goon, and the last time I saw them, he left them in the front door. Devante coughs. It's getting harder to breathe with all the smoke.
Man, we can't die up in here. I don't want to die.
Shut up, Chris says. We're not gonna die.
I cough into the crook of my arm. Daddy may have a spare, I say, and my voice is thin. In his office.
We rush back down the hall, but the office door is locked too.
Fuck!
Seven screams. Mr. Lewis limps into the middle of the street. He grips a baseball bat in each hand. He glances around like he's trying to figure out where the smoke is coming from. With the boards on the windows, he can't see the inferno in the store unless he looks through the front door.
Mr. Lewis!
I scream as loud as I can. The guys join in. The smoke strangles our voices. The flames dance feet away, but I swear it's like I'm standing in them. Mr. Lewis limps toward the store, squinting his eyes. They widen as he looks in through the door, straight at us on the other side of the flames.
Oh, Lord!
He limps into the street faster than I've ever seen him move.
Help! These kids stuck up in here! Help!
There's a loud crackling to our right. The fire takes out another shelf. Mr. Rubin's nephew, Tim, runs over and opens the front door, but the flames are too much.
Go to the back door, he calls to us.
Tim almost beats us getting there. He yanks hard on the door and the glass rattles. The way he's pulling, the door will come off eventually. We don't have eventually time, though. Tires screech outside. Moments later, Daddy runs up to the back door.
Watch out,
he tells Tim, moving him out the way. Daddy fumbles for his keys and sticks several in the lock while muttering, please, God, please. I can barely see Seven, Chris, or Devante for all the smoke, and they're coughing and wheezing next to me. A click. The knob turns. The door flies open. We rush out. Fresh air fills my lungs. Daddy pulls me and Seven through the alley around the corner and across the street to Reuben's. Tim gets Devante and Chris. They make us sit on the sidewalk. Tires screech again and Mama goes, oh my God! She runs over, Uncle Carlos on her heels. She holds my shoulders and helps me lie on the sidewalk. Breathe, baby, she says. Breathe. But I have to see. I sit up. Daddy attempts to run into the store for God knows what. The flames swat him back. Tim rushes a bucket of water from his uncle's restaurant. He runs into our store and douses it on the flames, but he's forced to jump back too. People trickle onto the street, and more buckets of sloshing water are hauled into the store. Ms. Yvette carries one from her beauty shop. Tim tosses it onto the fire. Flames eat away at the roof, and smoke billows from the windows of the barbershop next door.
My shop!
Mr. Lewis cries. Mr. Rubin stops him from running toward it.
My shop!
Daddy stands in the middle of the street, breathing hard, looking helpless. A crowd has gathered, and people watch with their hands pressed to their mouths. Bass rattles nearby. Daddy slowly turns his head. The gray BMW is parked in the intersection near the liquor store. King leans up against it. Some other King Lords stand alongside him and sit on the hood of the car. They laugh and point. King stares straight at Daddy and takes out his cigarette lighter. He sparks a flame. Aisha said King was gonna fuck us up because I dry snitched. That meant my whole family. This is it.
You son of a bitch!
Daddy marches toward King, and King's boys advance toward Daddy. Uncle Carlos stops him. The King Lords reach for their pieces and tell Daddy to bring it. King laughs like it's a comedy show.
You think this shit funny? Daddy yells. Punk ass, always hiding behind your boys.
King stops laughing.
Yeah, I said it. I ain't scared of you. You ain't shit to be scared of. Trying to burn up some kids, you fucking coward.
Oh. Mama starts for King, and Uncle Carlos has to work overtime to hold her back, too.
He burned Maverick's store down,
Mr. Lewis announces to everybody, in case we didn't hear.
King burned Maverick's store down!
It bubbles around the crowd, and narrowed eyes set on King. Of course, that's when the cops and the fire truck decide to show up. Of course, because that's how it works in Garden Heights. Uncle Carlos convinces my parents to back away. King lifts his cigar to his lips, eyes gleaming. I want to get one of Mr. Lewis's baseball bats and knock him upside his head. The firefighters get to work. The cops order the crowd to back up. King and his boys are really amused now. Shit, it's like the cops are helping them out.
You need to be getting them, Mr. Lewis says. They the ones who started the fire.
That old man don't know what he talking about, King says. All this smoke done got to him.
Mr. Lewis starts to charge at King, and an officer has to hold him back.
I ain't crazy. You did start it. Everybody know it.
King's face twitches.
You better watch yourself. Lying on folks.
Daddy glances back at me, and there's this expression on his face that I've never seen before. He turns around to the cop who's holding Mr. Lewis and says,
he ain't lying. King did start it, officer.
Holy shit. Daddy snitched.
It's my store, he says. I know he started the fire.
Did you see him do it? The cop asks. No, that's the problem. We know King did it, but if nobody saw it...
I saw him,
Mr. Rubin says.
He did it.
I saw him too, Tim says.
So did I,
Ms. Yvette adds. And shit, now the crowd is echoing the same thing, pointing at King and his boys. I mean, everybody snitching. The rules no fucking longer apply. King reaches for his car door, but some of the officers draw their guns and order him and his boys to the ground. An ambulance arrives. Mama tells them about our smoke inhalation. I snitch and tell them about Devante, although his black eye makes it obvious he needs help. They let the four of us sit on the curb, and they put oxygen masks on us. I thought I wasn't that bad anymore, but I forgot how nice clean air is. I've been breathing in smoke since I got to Garden Heights. They look at Devante's side. It's purple looking, and they tell him he'll need to go in for x-rays. He doesn't want to go in the ambulance, and Mama assures the paramedics that she'll take him in herself. I rest my head on Chris's shoulder as we hold hands, oxygen masks on both of us. I'm not going to lie and say tonight was better because he was here. Frankly, this has been one fucked up night. Nothing could make it better. But it doesn't hurt that we went through it together. My parents come our way. Daddy's lips thin, and he mumbles something to Mama. She elbows him and says, be nice. She sits between Chris and Seven. Daddy hovers over me and Chris at first, as if he's expecting us to make room for him. Maverick, Mama says.
Aight.
He sits on the other side of me. We watch the firefighters put out the flames. No point, though. They're only saving a shell of the store. Daddy sighs, rubbing his bald head.
Damn, man.
My heart aches. We're losing a family member for real. I've spent most of my life in that store. I move my head off Chris and rest it on Daddy's shoulder. He puts his arm around me and kisses my hair. I don't miss that smug look that crosses his face. Petty.
Wait a minute. He pulls away. Where the hell y'all been?
That's what I want to know, Mama says, acting like you can't answer my texts or calls. Really? Seven and I almost died in a fire. And they're mad because we didn't call them? I lift my mask and say, long night. Oh, I'm sure it was, Mama says. We got ourselves a little radical maverick. All on the news, throwing tear gas at the cops. After they threw it at us, I point out. What? Daddy says, but in that impressed way. Mama cuts him a side eye, and he says in a more stern tone, I mean, what? What you do that for? I was mad. I fold my arms onto my knees and stare at my Tims through the gap. That decision wasn't right. Daddy puts his arm around me again and rests his head against mine. A daddy snuggle. Nah, he says, it wasn't. Hey. Mama beckons me to look at her. The decision may not have been right, but it's not your fault. Remember what I said? Sometimes things will go wrong, but the key is to keep doing right. My eyes drift to my Tims again. Khalil still deserved better than that. Yeah. Her voice thickens. He did. Daddy looks past me at my boyfriend.
So, plain ass Chris.
Seven snorts, Devante snickers, Mama goes, Maverick, as I say, Daddy.
At least it's not white boy, Chris says.
Exactly, Daddy says. It's a step up. You gotta earn my tolerance in increments if you gonna date my daughter.
Lord. Mama rolls her eyes. Chris, baby, you've been out here all night? The way she says it, I can't help but laugh. She's basically asking him, you do realize you're in the hood, right?
Yes, ma'am, Chris says. All night.
Daddy grunts.
Maybe you do got some balls then.
My mouth drops and Mama says, Maverick Carter. Seven and Devante crack up. But Chris says,
yes, sir, I'd like to think I do.
Damn, says Seven.
He reaches to give Chris dap, but Daddy cuts him a hard eye, and he pulls his hand back.
Aight, plain ass Chris, Daddy says, boxing gym, next Saturday, you and me.
Chris lifts his oxygen mask so fast. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said,
calm down, I'm not gonna fight you, Daddy says. We gonna train. Get to know each other. You've been seeing my daughter for a minute now. I gotta know you, and you can learn a lot about a man at a boxing gym.
Oh.
Chris's shoulders relax.
Okay.
He puts the oxygen mask back on. Daddy grins. It's a little too mischievous for my liking. He's gonna kill my poor boyfriend. The cops load King and his boys into patrol cars, and the crowd claps and cheers. Finally, something to celebrate tonight. Uncle Carlos strolls over. He's got on a wife beater and shorts, which is so not Uncle Carlos. Yet something about him still looks detective-y. He's been in cop mode since his colleagues arrived. Uncle Carlos gives this old man grunt as he lowers himself onto the sidewalk next to Devante. He grabs the back of Devante's neck, the same way Daddy grabs Seven's. Man hugs, I call them.
I'm glad you're safe, kid, he says. Even if you do look like a truck ran over you twice. You not mad I left without telling y'all? Of course I'm mad. I'm actually pissed. But I'm happier that you're safe. Now my mom and Pam, that's a whole different story. I can't save you from their wrath.
Are you putting me out?
No. You're grounded, probably for the rest of your life, but that's only because we love you.
Devante cracks a smile. Uncle Carlos pats his knees.
So, Thanks to all these witnesses, we should get King for arson.
Oh, for real?
Daddy says. Yep, it's a start, but not really enough. He'll be out by the end of the week.
And back to the same old shit. With targets this time.
If y'all knew where King's stash was, Devante says, would that help? Uncle Carlos says,
probably, yeah.
If somebody agreed to rat on him, would that help?
Uncle Carlos turns completely toward him.
Are you saying you want to turn witness?
I mean,
Devante pauses.
Will it help Kenya, her mama, and her sister?
If King went to jail, says Seven, yeah, a lot. It'll help the whole neighborhood, honestly,
Daddy says.
And I'll be protected?
Devante asks Uncle Carlos.
Absolutely, I promise.
And Uncle Carlos always keeps his promises, I say. Devante nods for a moment.
Then I guess I will turn witness.
Holy shit again. You sure about that? I ask.
Yeah. After seeing you face those cops the way you did, I don't know, man. That did something to me, he says. And that lady said our voices are weapons. I should use mine, right?
So you're willing to become a snitch, Chris says.
On King, Seven adds.
Devante shrugs.
I already need the stitches. Might as well snitch.
Worst book ever. I can give a definitive conclusion on that. I don't care what happens in the final segment. It could be Gusty Renegade is the greatest in the world. They have this cool show called The Cows. Chris and Star started listening to it. I don't care what they say. This is the worst book we have ever read on The Cows. If nothing else, France Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth, has been supplanted on Gus's list for worst book of all time. And in fact, this might be the worst book I've ever read in my life. Almost want to put the age on this one to make it serious. I think this is in the running for sure. Worst book I have ever read in my life. Wow. Oh my God. Oh my God. And I kept thinking as I was reading, wow, if you don't understand racism, white supremacy, what it is, how it works, oh my. This ends up being, as I said at the very beginning, this book, it was the number one book on the New York Times Young Adult Bestseller list. It got supplanted, and now it is back 60 weeks on the New York Times Bestseller list and back at number one. The worst book I've ever read in my life, I think. Definitely the worst we've ever done in the book club. The Hate U Give. My oh. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. It's not even worst book we've ever read on the Cows Book Club. 6 years, we have read nothing worse than this. No contest, and it's not even close. If there's anybody out there who's read this book, black person, and says, my gosh, Gusty, you must be illiterate. You haven't been paying attention. Maybe you got to be something. Because this is phenomenal. And every black child in the world should read this book. It will boost their black self-respect. They will feel better about themselves. They will feel really great about black females by reading this book. If anybody out there, if that is your opinion, black person, 641 715-3640. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I had been thinking maybe I should invite Miss Thomas on the program, but I don't think I could do it because I couldn't have any integrity as Gus T without having to tell her this is, I think, the worst book I've ever read in my life. No contest. Woo! Even Daryl Bayne, remember Melanin Apocalypse, where black people were turning into zombies and being killed. They were still raping white women, of course. I am going to have to think. I think I would prefer that because I knew what that was going to be about going into, and I would take Melanin Apocalypse over The Hate U Give, and he even wrote young adult literature too. Anyway, folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, if you have thoughts, I guess one question I'll ask, why do you think, because I get the opinion that a lot of black people read and adore this book. What on earth do you think they appreciate about The Hate U Give? That'll be a question that I ask. And then certainly, if any listener is saying, my gosh, Gus T, you must, I don't know, what's going on? Chemtrails, got to be something. PTSD from the flood, something. You are sounding loony because this is phenomenally constructive counter-racist literature, and for young adults, black children, you just haven't been paying attention. Well, we need to hear from you, like, immediately, if that is the case. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York.
Well, Gus, I think I shared your sentiment from the first week. This is trash. This was the worst segment. This was the worst riot I've ever heard of. It's just terrible. Now, it's all over the place. You got the Chicago gang names with the King Lords and the Garden Disciples. Then they shout out the West Side, Ride or Die, so I'm thinking West Coast. And then King's wearing Timberland, so then I'm thinking East Coast. And then when they were dancing to the music, it was all music that was old and really popular, mostly in the southern region, you know, Cash Money, they were popular everywhere, but like No Limit and, you know, it was just the music they were playing, it was southern music, so it's like they're all over the country with this. It's like Oprah, or whatever her name is, was sending her legal authority to become an activist. I was like, come on, I mean, this is just so fake. Who does this? She's a lawyer. You know, she's going to be disbarred, you know, risk her career. I mean, you can't be an activist and a lawyer. The gangster's Jeep picking up the white people with the black people. I just thought that was tacky and terrible as well. You know, just terrible. Because I think we referenced this earlier, I think the firefighter did, when we had the L.A. riots. It was no white people getting help. I mean, they understood who the enemy was. Officer Cruz, you finally get a name for 115. And I think they kind of picked a more ambiguous name. Cruz could be a white person. It could be a Latino person, so-called Latino person. Hispanic, it could be a Mexican, it could be someone from the Spanish-speaking islands, but, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean look at the guy who just shot up the school down in Florida. His last name was Cruz, and he was white. It could also be a Filipino name, but it's a lot of Filipinos that have Spanish names like Cruz. So it's such an ambiguous name. Was the cop ever referred to as white, Gus, in this whole book?
I will have to. That is a good question. I'm gonna have to go back and check. I'll do that as we as you, you know, if you want to share. I will add. His name is spelled Cruise. If that matters.
Okay. So I'm thinking Cruz. So
that's what I was thinking too. But it's right. I've been looking at it for two months now. It's Cruise.
Okay. So, So that's like Tom. So, yeah, he's white.
Right.
Yeah, so, yeah, okay, I take back what I said. I don't have the book, and I'm glad I don't. My daughters do, but I think it's on the file, you know, version. However, Milk, the part where they poured the milk on the face is Devontae momentarily turned white. It was the way she said it. It just sounded so seductive, like, you know, it was, sounded erotic. And, you know, then, of course, she couldn't wait to grab a carton so she could pour it on her face. And I'm just thinking, you know, Chris earns his stripes. But the part where he's sitting in the oxygen mask next to Star, and it's Maverick is lobbying for a seat. He's kind of hovering over them. He doesn't quite know what to think. And, you know, they don't, he doesn't move over for her father. He's watching his store burn down. I mean, just again, no respect for Maverick. The whole way they did the King thing where everyone says, yeah, I saw him, now come on. And in the way they're positioning this, if you get rid of King, that doesn't change anything. Everyone that lives in this type of environment knows it's just going to be one of those people that are minions is just going to take his place. There's nothing else is going to change. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Oh, well, I was going to say, because I am still a flood victim, I do not have access to my library, don't have access to my word guide. I think Earn Your Stripes might be in the word guide. I could be incorrect, but that's kind of seems like something that might be there. I would even put a question mark by that one in terms of Saturday's compensatory calling with the metaphors. Retired firefighter or anybody, if you have Mr. Fuller's word guide around, if you could check to just see if that's there, that would be nice if it is. Either way, just to know, you know. But retired firefighter, proceed.
Greetings, everyone. First, I would say if this was something that I privately picked up, I probably would have stopped reading it the moment I found out on who Chris was. Speaking of non-white black young people, I can see where this book would have influence on them, primarily from all of the propaganda that they get from watching television. Unfortunately, non-white black people watch a whole lot of television. It is a lot synonymous with what you have heard or have even seen on TV, because it's the same white people who is behind it, who are editing in a racist, white supremacist way, things that would attract non-white people to their philosophy. And when you're in and around your teenage years, you are very, very it's a situation where you're very open to be influenced. And because I spent a lot of time around teenagers, and I've seen it over 30 some odd years, and over those 30 years, it hasn't really changed. Just been improved more in a negative way. Although they are able to listen to someone who has something that's constructive from a counter-racist standpoint. But unfortunately, right now we're overwhelmed. We meaning people who are attempting to practice some sort of logical counter-racist codification, we're overwhelmed by confusion. Once again, the chapter, Chris, you know, comes out you know, as white Jesus, a group of terrible niggas gets their just due and gets sent off to jail. And as Mr. Thomas said, that in reality they're only going to be replaced by somebody else, you know, as far as they're concerned. But nevertheless, it sounds heroic in a book, you know, as far as they're concerned. A lot of unrealistic things. As I mentioned to everybody, I've been a part on the professional level and as a quote unquote activist in at least 3 or 4 rebellions down here in South Florida, in the Miami area. And from the job standpoint, you don't have a protest and a riot in the same place. That's, you know, I can't make it more plainer than that. You don't have a protest and a riot in the same place. The police are going to behave the same way where once they start, they're going to keep going. And as I mentioned before, even realistically in the book, it pretends that tanks, because I've heard the word twice, that tanks are there on day one. And that never happens, you know, because those are big items and they have to be transported. And then the governor of that state actually makes those decisions. So it takes a while for those things to come about. But nevertheless, as I mentioned before, you don't have a protest and a riot in the same place, one or the other, as far as and primarily it's going to be protests. And then once the police have had enough of it, then it's going to go full scale as far as containing that situation. You know, as far as that concerned, ain't gonna be nobody out there with no bullhorns on top of police cars at that particular point in time. So I hope everybody understands on what I'm talking about. The most person who is best represents counter racist logic, the dad, is put down and basically relaxed to the standpoint to whereas he's no threat or anything to that makes any sense, you know, that sort of thing. Just totally disrespected. The mom stays in charge, which is nothing wrong with a female being in charge, but I'm talking about in this scripted edited way, is the way that best assists the global system of racism and white supremacy, as far as that concerned. And Chris representing white people, and like I said before, you're not gonna find a situation where a white person is in the middle once rioting takes place. But that's Jesus; he can get away with all of that in a book. You know, as far as that concerned. And that's all I have to say right now. Thank you.
Do we have other folks who have a hand up who have commentary? And this is, we have one more audio segment, but this is the last session period on this text. So final thoughts, concluding thoughts. If you want to take if you have commentary on the question that was presented, feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yikes, look at all that. Let's get Red in Nevada.
Hello, and thank you for allowing me to share. Hello, everyone. Just one brief comment or two brief comments from last week because I missed the reading, but I listened to the audio. I definitely agree with Thomas in New York sentiment about the whole them using King as the bad person and how, you know, some black people, they call each other kings and queens, and, you know, this is your king. But, you know, with their kings, King Leopold, King James, the one who their Bible is written after, their indiscretions are just, you know, not brought up. So I thought that, you know, maybe that could also be another sign of the book being ghostwritten. The other thing is that Chris being light-skinned or temporary black, something that is just that made me, you know, really just basically sick to my stomach. I actually recently heard that on my job, where a white, just because a white person knew extensively, I guess, quote unquote, black music or rap music, they're like, oh, you didn't know that he was black? This is clearly a suspected racist. And it was just supposed to be, you know, a joke. There was something that a white woman said to me about a white man. I didn't get to hear the first audio, but just listen to some of the commentary. Just going back again on to Maverick, this cannot be the author's favorite character, because he has been one of the most abused people throughout the text. He's treated, you know, worse than King, who has, you know, done, you know, he's still supposed to be this quote unquote gangster and all that that entails. But it seems like Maverick is constantly being talked down to, constantly being demasculinized by the wife, by everyone, really. And there's no way that that could be your favorite person, unless that's how you want a black male to be treated. And the only thing that I can say that maybe could be the reason why this could be the quote-unquote book of Black Lives Matter, because I know I constantly hear from different black people, mainly black females, who talk about Black Lives Matter being a good thing, is that, well, it was started by anti-sexual, they don't use anti-sexual, of course, but started by anti-sexual black females, you know, showing that black females are, you know, strong and leaders. And that's basically at least one thing, that a reoccurring theme throughout the book, with the wife earning more, I'm sorry, with Star's mom earning more than the father. I think I wouldn't be surprised if Uncle Carlos's wife, I forgot her name, but if she also earns more, because she's a surgeon and Carlos is a detective, if she earns more than Carlos. And it just kind of seems like, you know, women, we didn't hear anything about Maya's father, nothing from Maya's father, but there was that one part where Maya's mother answered the door and she was talking to her assistant. So it was kind of like, okay, well, women are the ones who are, you know, really leading the world in this, that, and the other. And it can't be something that is a cohesive union between males and females, males and females, because the men and women I really don't care about, white men, white women I really don't care about. But I guess, I did get a chance to speak with a non-white female. She's actually going to be heading off to college soon, and she was saying that her black student union had given her this book. She says she only read the back, she didn't read the front of it, so she didn't really have too much of an opinion on it. But I definitely let her know, because it was supposed to be they were having a book study about it. So I kind of gave her my opinion, and also her father my opinion of, you know, what the book was, which is basically nothing. We've learned nothing from this book other than basically what has happened in real life, except from a point of view from a black female who was being sexually sewered by a racist. And I'll leave it there. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that, Red in Nevada. Before we get our next caller, just a metric that I think is significant. I have the ebook, so you can do word searches. Officer Cruz and 115, those two references combined are mentioned about 50 times in the text, either Officer Cruz or 115. King, talking about this black male who burned down Maverick's store and, you know, has been doing all these other terrorist acts, disrupted the funeral, is mentioned more than 50 times in the text. Just that alone, I think, is highly significant in a book that is the Black Lives Matter text for young adults. Mr. Demery Ford, were you going to comment, sir?
Yes. May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Gus. greetings and greetings to other callers and listeners. I was really enjoying the commentary from the other callers. Your question, you know, I'm going to, you know, for the sake of playing devil's advocate, I'm going to attempt to see if I can draw some positive from this book, but I'm going to fail miserably, I know. But the book should encourage self-respect and try to teach responsibility, self-control, courage, and empathy towards others. I guess, you know, she attempted to do that. But in so doing, there's no respect given to Maverick. That's been brought up several times by everyone. But where Maverick should have been admired for his resilient effort to become self-sufficient, you know, in a society that denigrates ex-cons, especially felons, a felony conviction in America, especially if you're a black male, is almost a death sentence in itself. If you know, we got books on that, the new Jim Crow, you know, I couldn't even finish it. So it's just mind-blowing what happens if you get a felony conviction. But the trauma, the terrorism, racial oppression can make insanity seems normal. In the case with Star thinking that, you know, she wants normal, what she thinks is normal is really a form of insanity. I mean, because she's getting close and showing affection to an individual that looks like the police officer that had just killed her lifelong friend, an unarmed black man that wasn't doing anything. And then later on, we got Devontae and Star showing concern for Chris during the, I guess they got caught up in the riot. They worried about Chris. Devontae himself was already injured. And then if Chris takes it upon himself to go into a black area, then he's on his own. And it just seemed really odd for them to be showing some type of concern in a situation like this. And the Just for Justice, I wanted to bring that up. That when they mentioned the colors of the van, you know, the red, green, and yellow, but the colors, I guess, for black unity or that we have accepted as the colors would be red, green, yellow, and black. Do not leave the black out. You know, that may or may not be of interest. But then black-owned businesses, you know, paint that on your businesses, you know, and they still got burned up. It's just, you know, this book just fails miserably in any type of constructive material you could have in for counter-racism. In the middle of the riot, you know, the guys, I guess, shows up and he's picking up people and he's picking up white people in the middle of the riot. You know, I mean, it's, if it wasn't so hilarious, I mean, it would just be downright ridiculous. Mr. Lewis, who was dismissed as this old fool, you know, didn't know what he's talking about earlier, turns out to be, you know, one of the heroes because he saves the day. And then you got all these blacks, so-called, chimping out, okay, burning down your own neighborhood over an injustice in the black community, but that overshadows the racist whites who created this suffering and terror and death, okay? And it's supposed to be something to celebrate when King gets arrested. And then a lot of emphasis was given on snitching. And I guess bringing up the fact that black people don't like to snitch. Snitches get stitches. But in this case, in this book's bringing out, that snitching sometimes black people, you know, it's supposed to be good to snitch. They stick to the no snitching rule to their own detriment, you know, supposedly, according to this book. But I'll mute my line on that, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Appreciate that, Mr. Demery Four. Again, our well wishes to your wife. Run up the tab. I was going to make sure I got in as well. Reginald Denny, white man who was pummeled during the 1992 disturbances, suspected racist who was pummeled, he was assisted by a black person. So one could submit that, hey, this is based on historical record that there are black people who do this sort of thing in real life, and you got video footage. Yes, this sort of thing has happened repeatedly. Jay in St. Louis, did you have commentary, sir? Perhaps no.
Hello?
Oh, yes, we can hear you. Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. Hold on. Let me just pull up my notes. I thought it was, I thought the movie, well, I said the movie, but that's what I was exactly about to compare this to. The book is like a very cliche movie script. I thought it was very interesting that the cops come in at the end and like represent a restoration of order and good things are happening. They're taking away that bad king, and now we can enjoy ourselves because that dirty Negro is locked away. So, you know, I just thought that was like crazy. Out of all that chaos, they kind of come in as the heroes at the end of all of it, even though they were supposed to be the problem in the beginning. Let's see, Chris, I feel like Chris is kind of just, I feel like when they were taking him through the neighborhood, it was like tourism almost, like they were kind of like escorting him around. It was kind of like theater. It was real, I didn't like the way it was presented. It seemed very it seemed to have a lot of malice and like a slant to it. Like she was revealing her dirty real life. This is where I'm really from. And it made it like spaces that have black people in them are like all scary and anything can happen and your car shut down. It was like some type of knockoff horror movie. Like everything that can go bad did because we came to this dark part of town. And that's all I took down. Thanks for letting me speak.
I just appreciate that, Jay in St. Louis. I keep going back to one of the interviews that Ms. Thomas did, who allegedly wrote this book. I feel very confident in saying that now. She said she was talking about, again, she was same interview where she was talking about Maverick being her favorite character. She was talking about, it'll come back to me, man. I had so many other things. Did we miss any of the other callers? While I see if I get my thought back for the interview. Did we miss any of the other callers? Any of the folks who had a hand up? Grand, we do have one more audio segment. So if you have a thought, if you have a question, anything that you want to make sure you get in. If we have any folks who enjoyed the book and think all of the, I guess, critical commentary has missed the mark and maybe we weren't paying attention, feel free, chime in. People wrote in. I guess you could do that too, untiljustice@gmail.com if you want to write in. A number of people wrote in, even from the end of last week's session all the way through like today, people wrote in. So I'll get all of those comments out of the way and then I'll share a word or two. So comment number one, this is from our black mom in the Bay Area. Excuse me. My friend has a daughter who read the book last year. I asked her this morning her views on the book. She's 13 years old. Man. 13-year-old reading this book? Wow.
It was not required reading. She attends an African-centered school. I asked her several questions pertaining to the book. She said she really liked the book because it was relatable and reminded her of her family. Some of her relatives were dealers, so the children of the dealers could relate to each other. The foul language is how they communicate already. The police brutality is being introduced to them now, so they are getting a feel of the letdown because there is no repercussion for the officers who do the killing. She said Star should have stopped being friends with Haley a long time ago because she was showing signs of being racist. She said Chris was very understanding and supportive to Star. Interracial dating was cool, and people should be able to date whoever they want. I've heard that so many times. She said Maverick was a typical hood dad. He was more of a father than the uncle was. He would have been better if he was allowed to be. The mother would control him and did not allow him to make decisions. She felt he was being forever punished for having Seven with the other lady. How about that? She said it was Seven's job to look after the women in his life because he has a male and they are supposed to be the protector. I asked about Khalil, and she said she should have found another way to support the family. She could also relate to him selling drugs because by any means necessary, he had to take care of his family, and she would have done the same. I asked her, why did she think white people like this book? Great question. She said, because it gives them a window of the black reality. Oh, whew, man. I need a glass of water on. That's what I've done. That right there. That right there is exactly why one of the worst that we've read on the book club, perhaps the worst that I've ever read for that exact sentiment. Give the question again. I asked her why she thinks, oh, it got moved down. My screen moved down. Let me scroll back up. I asked her, why does she think white people like the book? She said, because it gives them a window of the black reality. She also said the stereotypes were used to make white people think we are all about shoes, material things, destruction, violence, and fatty foods. She even got the food point. How could you miss the food? It's so... Anyway, she said Star should have always stayed the same, not being one way at school, another way at home. She could relate to Star because she used to go to school to a white school and lived in a white neighborhood before going to the African school. The damage that the cocktail did is the reason they moved and sent the children to the African school. I personally believe the book was edited to make sure the children could relate to the book and its characters. The way we collectively allow our children to have this carefree attitude about the life we live, everything is okay. If we second guess anything, we're being judgmental. The way they have our children programmed, they can relate to anything negative and destructive. As parents, we have this everyone else is doing it attitude due to everything and everyone else having input on how we develop our children. This book fits right into the destruction. I am sure the movie will be the icing on the cake as far as aiding in the brain damage of you, of us, and our children. Next person that wrote in, and this black male educator, I'd like to thank everyone who participated in this book club. I'm sure that this will be a big help to young non-white people all over the country. This book really made me think about the current state of confusion non-white people are in. I don't see how any logical thinker can find this book constructive for young non-white children. This book will surely make young non-white children even more confused, especially with the way it glorifies sex, violence, and poor language. I know that this book satisfies the category of fiction for the book club, but I do think the book Dear Martin would be helpful to use for the book club at some point. It's not as popular as The Hate U Give, but it is also a book that many non-white schools are using in their curriculums. Let's see. Oh, this is workplace. Never mind. We got those in. Quick comments that I can give. The riot scene in this book,
I don't know if we have listeners who have been. The book club is 6 years. That in and of itself, I think when we read Frantz Fanon, Wretched of the Earth last summer, I read a list of all of the books that we've read on the book club, which is pretty darn impressive, if I do say so myself. 6 years that we've been doing the book club. That is saying quite a bit to say, you know, worst ever. But if you were here when we read Dr. William Pierce, The Turner Diaries, the riot scene in this book where they literally Maverick's store is burning down while the car stereo is blaring. Like, are you serious? That scene and the whole, the entirety of what's been going on during this quote unquote riot. If people remember Dr. William Pierce, The Turner Diaries, we read that on the book club as well. And yes, I think that book is better than this. In that book, he has a scene where black people, I think he even mentions they're listening to George Clinton as they're committing their like hooligan. And it reminded me of that scene. I don't know if any of you all heard it or remember when we did the book club. I think he mentioned George Clinton because this, I think the Turner Diaries was published in like the 70s originally. And one of George Clinton's songs was like number one at the time. So he mentions George Clinton. When I went back and did the edit, I put the George Clinton music in. That's one of the reasons why it's really, really memorable for me. Anyway, that's number one. Next, some of the other things that stood out for me in the text, the point that Thomas made about the milk and the whiteness covering Devante, I had the exact same thought about the milk because whiteness has been glorified in so many different ways, whether it's Jess's perfect pixie cut, who she was sexually attracted to, her hair was so nice, or Chris, I mean, it's Chris being perfect and normal, and it's been glorified in so many ways. I had the same sentiment. The make sure I'm not missing. From chapter 23, some of the things that stood out, or excuse me, 24, sorry. From 24, some of the things that stood out. When Chris is articulating, I guess he's willing to go to Taco Bell if Star, as long as she's there, he's willing to go with her. Just the whole tackiness about all of this. Like, yeah, I don't even know what that's supposed to signify, that I'm cool enough or I'm tough enough that I can go to the hood Taco Bell. And it's not like just everything about that, just repulsive. Let's see. The whole, this is like reality. I guess that's the other thing too. When mom in the Bay Area who talked to the 13-year-old black girl about the text, and she said that she thinks white people like this book because this is black reality, or this is the way that they like to see black people projected. I'll say it that way, which I agree. I think that's why they like it too. But things like the Rottweiler on a leash in a fenced-in yard barks and struggles to come after us. I stomp at it with my foot. Like, they like this. All of the Negro trauma drama. Give us more of that. More of it, the better. Yes. When it continues, I mean, how is your attorney? Like, I'm thinking, since white people like to talk about O.J. Simpson, Johnny Cochran. Can you imagine Johnny Cochran coming out and standing on top of a police vehicle with a mega? I mean, this is like total minstrelsy. Like, this is not any sort of like serious analysis or, in my view, trying to present material to young black children, since that's the audience, I would think, for a young adult novel, presenting material so that they can get, you know, a cohesive understanding of racism and these police shootings. That's not what we're focused on. We're focused on doing our swirl and hooking up with Chris and snitching. And why are black people all into this no snitch? I mean, it's not focused at all. We forgot all about 115. We forgot all about Officer Cruz. Like, Wow. Instead of all of that, we're focused on niggers running out of the Walmart and carrying armfuls of items looking like ants rushing from an anthill. That's why I say pay attention to the metaphors. Not even people, just little nigger ants scurrying to and from, stealing white people, the good Walmart people's goods. Pause for Jonathan Crawford III. It's just tacky all the way through. Like, there's nothing redeemable from this at all. Like, just listening for the, I don't know what it was, like 50 minutes or so. I giggled. I was repulsed. I just kind of oscillated back and forth between just laughing and being repulsed and just eventually concluding, if you do not understand racism, white supremacy, that's how you end up thinking that something like this is constructive. And that 13-year-olds, 11-year-olds, 11-year-old and 13-year-old black children should be reading something like this. Might be better if they just watched Empire for an hour. Seriously. Chapter 25. Just why do we, in a book that's supposed to be about Black Lives Matter, why does a character have to be named Goon? I'm sure there are individuals out there. Well, there, I know 20,000 black people that, oh yeah, they're named Goon. That's authentic. Nothing about that should be glorified. The system of white supremacy, as Mr. Fuller says frequently, makes monsters and monstrosities. I am not interested at all in having 11 and 13-year-old black children read books where the black characters are going to be called Goon. Continue, even if he's going to be cool and chauffeur the whites around during the uprising, throwing up gang signs all the way. The sentence when the store is burned, because I've talked about the importance of Maverick. This is the author, alleged author's favorite character. When the store burns down, the sentence, Daddy stands in the middle of the street, breathing hard, looking helpless. Favorite character in the book. And again, this is the same thing that I said, where I guess it was not last week, whenever a few weeks back when Mr. Lewis, when he was quote unquote snitching on camera and he was saying if somebody needs to be beat, if somebody needs to be got, it needs to be that king, not Officer Cruz. It needs to be this black person. Same thing again. Uncle Carlos convinces my parents to back away. King lifts his cigar to his lips, eyes gleaming. I want to get one of Mr. Lewis's baseball bats and knock him upside his head. Not 115. Knock a black person upside the head with a baseball bat. How in the world? How in the world can that be the climax in a book that is supposed to be the Black Lives Matter book about police terrorism? Come on, man. And then snitching. We just go back and forth between anti-blackness, black people focusing on and terrorizing other black people, and snitching. And again, the greatest, the people with the best no snitch policy in the universe, hands down, whites. If they just snitched on other whites, we wouldn't have a racism problem. They do the no snitch policy better than anybody. Continuing, this will be my last thing that I get in. So the dad's store has been burned down. We've had black people snitching on other black people. Boom, boom, boom. Who knows? Officer Cruz is, I guess, getting his money in the background, doing whatever he's doing. She says, my heart aches. We're losing a family member, talking about the store. I spent most of my life in that store. I moved my head off Chris and rested on Daddy's shoulder. He puts his arm around me and kisses my hair. Like, we're in the middle of all of this, and we still got to make sure, getting her swirl on. Chris right there, head on his shoulder. As I've said, this is not a book about police terrorism. This is a book that is propagandizing, quote unquote, interracial relationships to very young black people. I always think Dr. Kamau Kamban, it is a race to the mind. He says that all the time. Who can get to the mind first? And in my view, it would seem to me to be one of the primary objectives, if not the primary objective. Hey, you should be A-okay. Exactly what the 13-year-old said, quote unquote, interracial relationships are cool. The whole scene with Dad and Maverick is super extra tacky. That sounds like exactly what a racist, and to me, what a racist man would say about saying, Chris, oh, you have some balls because you hung out in the Negro area of town, on the dark town, on the dark side of town, as they say. You hung out over here during the uprising. You have some balls. That sounds like exactly what I would expect from the brain computer of racist man, not a black female. I could be totally, totally wrong. Anybody have any other comments they wanted to get in?
Just, you know, I thought Johnny Cochran, as soon as she did it, I said, man, Johnny Cochran wouldn't have did this. You said there's not going to be a second audio where we get the speech, so I just want to...
There is another audio. There is another audio.
I mean, session where we get to talk after the next audio. Are you going to allow people to speak again? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to close out with the last audio. Well, yeah, I just wanted to reiterate that this was very tacky and trashy. And, of course, you know, now Dad's going to take Chris to the gym and, you know, talking him up a little and learn more about him. So, now I will say, give a positive to the book. I like the genre as far as, if you're going to write a book, the language, the some of the situations I could see, the total overall packaging of everything, I didn't like. And it's very unauthentic. I think that I would really love if you was to bring this lady on to the show and just to find out if we could think that she really did like this book or not. Just ask questions. You know, where did you come up with this concept from? See if she got any of this stuff from the movies that we've already pointed out, Boys in the Hood here, Poetic Justice there. And the last thing, and this is a question because I don't remember, has she and Chris had sex yet? I know that he did finger her, but did he actually get to have actual intercourse with her yet?
No. They had a sexual moment last week, but it seemed like she was initiating, being the aggressor, they might say, but he stopped things.
Okay. So yeah, I was going to say he's definitely getting some now. He survived the hood. He had the AOK from Dad. The mom has already seemed like she's very cool with it. I think that the commentary you read said is very feminist in its premise. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Any other comments? Folks want to make sure they get in.
I would say, although this book is very negative, there is a lot of instances that is depicted in this book that, unfortunately, a lot of non-white black young people are actually acting out, including relationships with people like Chris. And the book basically kind of like encourages it. It basically encourages it, you know, from that standpoint. And because as I've mentioned before, I've spent a lot of time around black teenagers. And I've also been in environments where there are young white people as well as young non-white black people. And I don't know if y'all remember me talking about the black male. He's happened to be at Florida International University right now. A lot of the coaches were calling Spade, and he has been with a white female during his entire time in high school. My son is telling me he's not at FIU anymore.
Oh, he's not with the girl
anymore. But during the time in high school, he was with this white female, and I've seen it a lot. So the book basically encourages it, keeps it going. It's a very devastating, quote unquote, excellent weapon against countering the system of racism and white supremacy, I would say. Okay.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Any other folks have commentary they wanted to get in before we do have another audio segment. It's shorter than usual, but we are at the end of the text. So any other comments folks want to get in? Assume folks are satisfied. Jay in St. Louis, I'm going to see if I can jog my memory so I can even get my final comment in related to the interview that she did. You had a quick comment, just if you could kind of restate the main point that you were making. Oh, are you still with us, sir? Not sure if he's able to speak now. I thought he was still there. Oh, well, we'll get him on. Other side, I'll ask again and see if I can get my last point related to her interview that she did back. This was a few months earlier. She's done more recent interviews. She even did an interview within the last like few weeks. I was going to play that today, but it didn't really add nothing new or striking. With that, we will get to the last audio segment of the text. Thank goodness. I'm so glad to be wrapping the book up. I do keep in mind, though, that young black people, because so many black children are being required to read this book, that young black people might be listening to the program. So hopefully, if we have shared anything constructive, it might help them get a better understanding of racism, better understanding of white supremacy, what it means to be classified as white, and to not be brain trashed by reading The Hate U Give, allegedly written by Angie Thomas. We're picking up chapter 26. I'm just going to check ahead to see, is this the last chapter? Yes, last chapter, last and final chapter, Context of White Supremacy.
26. It's around 11 the next morning, and I'm still in bed. After the longest night ever, I had to seriously get reacquainted with my pillow. My mom flicks on the lights in my new room. Good Lord, there's too many lights in here. Star, your partner in crime is on the phone, she says. Who? I mumble. Your protest partner in crime. Mama told me she saw her hand you that bullhorn on TV, putting you in danger like that. But she didn't mean to put me in. Oh, I've dealt with her already, don't worry. Here. She wants to apologize to you. Miss Ofra does apologize for putting me in a bad situation and for the way things turned out with Khalil. But she says she's proud of me. She also says she thinks I have a future in activism. Mama leaves with the phone, and I turn onto my side. Tupac stares back at me from a poster, a smirk on his face. The Thug Life tattoo on his stomach looks bolder than the rest of the photo. It was the first thing I put in my new room, kind of like bringing Khalil with me. He said Thug Life stood for the hate you give little infants fucks everybody. We did all that stuff last night because we were pissed. And it fucked all of us. Now we have to somehow unfuck everybody. I sit up and grab my phone off my nightstand. There are texts from Maya, who saw me on the news and thinks I'm dope personified, and texts from Chris. His parents grounded him, but he says it was so worth it, it really was. There's another text from Haley, of all people. Two simple words. I'm sorry. Not what I expected. Not that I expected to get anything from her. Not that I even want to deal with her. This is the first time she's spoken to me since our fight. I'm not complaining. She's been non-existent to me, too.
I respond anyway. Sorry for what? I'm not being petty. Petty would be saying, new number, who dis? There's a damn near endless list of things she could be apologizing for. About the decision, she says. And that you're upset with me. Haven't been myself lately. Just want everything to be how it used to be. The sympathy for the case is nice, but she's sorry I'm upset? That's not the same as apologizing for her actions or the garbage she said. She's sorry I reacted the way I did. Oddly enough, I needed to know that. You see, it's like my mom said, if the good outweighs the bad, I should keep Haley as a friend. There's a shit ton of bad now. An overload of bad. I hate to admit that a teeny tiny part of me hoped Haley would see how wrong she was. But she hasn't. She may not ever see that. And you know what? That's fine. Okay. Maybe not fine, because it makes her a shitty-ass person. But I don't have to wait around for her to change. I can let go. I reply. Things will never be the way they used to be. I hit send, wait for the text to go through, and delete the conversation. I delete Haley's number from my phone, too. I stretch and yawn as I creep down the hall. The layout of our new house is way different than our old one, but I think I can get used to it. Daddy clips some roses at the kitchen counter. Next to him, Sakani inhales a sandwich, and Bricks stands on his hind legs with his paws on Sakani's lap. He watches the sandwich the same way he watches a squirrel. Mama flips switches on the wall. One causes a grinding noise in the sink, and another turns the lights off and on. Too many switches, she mumbles and notices me. Oh, look, Maverick. It's our little revolutionary. Brick scuttles over to me and jumps up my legs, tongue wagging. Morning, I tell him, and scratch behind his ears. He gets down and returns to Sakani and the sandwich.
Do me a favor, Star, Seven says, searching through a box that has kitchen stuff written on it in my handwriting. Next time, be more specific about what type of kitchen stuff is in the box. I've gone through three trying to find plates.
I climb onto a stool at the counter. Lazy butt, isn't that what paper towels are for? Seven narrows his eyes.
Hey, Pops, guess where I picked Star up from yesterday?
The plates are in the bottom of that box, I say.
Thought so.
My middle finger wants to extend so bad. Daddy says,
you bet not have been at that boy's house. I know that.
I force a smile. No, of course not. I'm gonna kill Seven. Daddy sucks his teeth.
Uh-huh.
He goes back to work on his roses. An entire bush lies on the counter. The roses are dry, and some of the petals have fallen off. Daddy sets the bush in a clay pot and pours dirt over the roots. Will they be all right? I ask.
Yeah. A little damaged, but alive. I'm gonna try something different with them. Putting them in new soil can be like hitting a reset button.
Star, Sakani says, mouth full of wet bread and meat. Nasty. You're in the newspaper. Stop talking with your mouth full, boy, Mama scolds. Daddy nods toward the newspaper on the counter.
Yeah, check it out, little Black Panther.
I'm on the front page. The photographer caught me mid-throw. The can of tear gas smokes in my hand. The headline reads, The Witness Fights Back. Mama rests her chin on my shoulder. They've discussed you on every news show this morning. Your Nana calls every 5 minutes, telling us a new channel to watch. She kisses my cheek. I know you better not scare me like that again. I won't. What are they saying on the news?
They calling you brave, Daddy says. But you know, that one network got a complaint saying you put them cops in danger.
I didn't have a problem with those cops. I had a problem with that tear gas can, and they threw it first.
I know, baby. Don't even stress it. That whole network can kiss my...
Dollar Daddy!
Sakani grins up at him. Roses. They can kiss my roses.
He smudges dirt on Sakani's nose.
You ain't getting another dollar out of me. He knows, Seven says, glaring at Sakani.
Sakani gets guilty puppy dog eyes that could give Bricks some competition.
Mama moves her chin off my shoulder.
Okay, what's that about?
Nothing. I told Sakani we gotta be careful with money now.
He said we might have to go back to Garden Heights, too, Sakani rats. Do we?
No, of course not, Mama says. Guys, we'll make this work.
Exactly, Daddy says. If I have to sell oranges on the side of the street like the Nation Brothers, we'll make it.
Is it okay to leave, though? I ask. I mean, the neighborhood is messed up. What are people going to think about us leaving instead of helping fix it? Never, ever thought I'd say something like that. But last night has me thinking about all of this so differently. About me differently. About Garden Heights differently.
We can still help fix it, Daddy says.
Right. I'm gonna do extra shifts at the clinic, Mama says.
And I'm gonna figure something out to do about the store till I get it renovated, says Daddy. We ain't gotta live there to change things, baby. We just gotta give a damn, aight?
All right. Mama kisses my cheek and runs a hand over my hair. Look at you. Community-minded all of a sudden. Maverick, what time did the claims agent say he was coming? Daddy closes his eyes and pinches the space between them.
In a couple of hours. I don't even want to see it.
It's okay, Daddy, Sakani says, with a mouthful of sandwich. You don't have to go by yourself. We'll go with you. So we do. Two police cars block off the entrance to Garden Heights. Daddy shows them his ID and explains why we need to go in. I'm able to breathe during the whole exchange, and they let us through. Damn. I see why they aren't letting people in, though. Smoke has taken up permanent residence, and glass and all kinds of trash litter the streets. We pass so many blackened frames of what used to be businesses. The store is the hardest to see. The burned roof folds into itself like the slightest wind will knock it over. The bricks and burglar bars protect charred rubble. Mr. Lewis sweeps the sidewalk in front of his shop. It's not as bad off as the store, but a broom and a dustpan won't make it better. Daddy parks in front of the store and we get out. Mama rubs and squeezes Daddy's shoulder. Star, Sakani whispers and looks back at me. The store. His eyes have tears in them, and then mine do too. I drape my arms over his shoulders and hug him to me. I know, man. A loud creaking sound approaches, and somebody whistles a tune. 40-ounce pushes his shopping cart down the sidewalk. As hot as it is, he's wearing his camouflage coat. He comes to an abrupt stop in front of the store like he just noticed it.
Goddamn, Maverick, he says in that fast 40-ounce way where it all sounds like one word. What the hell happened? Man, where were you last night? Daddy says. My store got burned up. I went on the other side of the freeway. Couldn't stay here. Oh, no, I knew these fools would go crazy. You got insurance? I hope you do. I got insurance.
What for? I ask. Because seriously.
My life,
he says, like it's obvious.
You gonna rebuild, Maverick? I don't know, man. I gotta think about it. You have to, because now we won't have no store. Everybody else gonna leave and never come back. I'll think about it. Okay,
If you need anything, let me know.
And he pushes his cart down the sidewalk, but comes to an abrupt stop again.
The liquor store gone too? Oh no!
I snicker. Only 40 ounce. Mr. Lewis limps over with his broom.
That fool got a point. Folks will need a store around here. Everybody else gonna leave.
I know, Daddy says.
It's a lot, Mr. Lewis. I know it is, but you can handle it. I told Clarence what happened.
He says of Mr. Wyatt, his friend who used to own the store.
He thinks you ought to stick around. And we were talking, and I think it's about time for me to do like him. Sit on a beach and watch some pretty women.
You closing the shop? Seven asks. Who's gonna cut my hair? Sicani adds. Mr. Lewis looks down at him.
Not my problem. Since you're gonna be the only store around here, Maverick, you'll need more space when you rebuild. I want to give you the shop.
What? Mama sputters.
Whoa, now wait a minute, Mr. Lewis.
Daddy says.
Wait, nothing. I got insurance, and I'm gonna get more than enough from that. Ain't nothing I can do with a burned-up shop. You can build a nice store, give folks something to be proud to shop in. All I ask is that you put up some pictures of Dr. Kang alongside your Nui, whoever he was.
Daddy chuckles.
Huey Newton. Yeah, him. I know y'all moving, and I'm glad. But the neighborhood still needs more men like you, even if you just run in a store.
The insurance man arrives a little later, and Daddy gives him a tour of what's left. Mama gets some gloves and garbage bags from the truck, passes them to me and my brothers, and tells us to get to work. It's kind of hard with people driving by and honking their horns. They yell out stuff like, "Keep y'all heads up," or "We got your back." Some of them come and help out, like Mrs. Rooks and Tim. Mr. Reuben brings us ice-cold bottles of water, 'cause this sun ain't no joke. I sit on the curb, sweating, tired, and 100% ready to be done. We aren't anywhere near finished. A shadow casts over me and somebody says, "Hey." I shield my eyes as I look up. Kenya's wearing an oversized t-shirt and some basketball shorts. They look like Seven's. "Hey." She sits next to me and pulls her knees up to her chest. "I saw you on TV," she says. "I told you to speak out, but damn, Star, you took it kind of far." "It got people talking, though, didn't it?"
"Yeah.
Sorry about the store. I heard my daddy did it." "He did. No point in denying it, shoot. How's your mama?" Kenya pulls her knees closer. "He beat her. She ended up in the hospital. They kept her overnight. She got a concussion and a whole bunch of other stuff. But she'll be okay. We saw her a little while ago. The cops came. And we had to leave."
"Really?"
"Yeah. They raided our house earlier and wanted to ask her some questions. Me and Lyric gotta stay with Grandma right now."
Devante struck already.
"You okay with that?"
"I'm relieved, actually."
"Messed up, huh?"
"Nah, not really."
She scratches one of her cornrows, which somehow makes all of them move in the same back and forth motion.
"I'm sorry for calling Seven my brother and not our brother."
"Oh, I kind of forgot about that. It seems minor after everything that's happened."
"It's all right.
I guess I called him my brother 'cause it made me feel like he really was my brother, you know?"
"He is your brother, Kenya. I honestly get jealous of how much he wants to be with you and Lyric."
"Because he thinks he has to be," she says. "He wants to be with y'all. I mean, I get why. He and Daddy don't get along. But I wish he wanted to be my brother sometimes and didn't feel like he had to be. He ashamed of us. 'Cause of our mama and my daddy."
"No, he's not."
"Yeah, he is.
You ashamed of me, too.
I've never said that.
You didn't have to, Star, she says. You never invited me to hang out with you and them girls. They were never at your house when I was. Like you ain't want them to know I was your friend, too. You were ashamed of me. Khalil, even the gardener, and you know it.
I go quiet. If I face the truth, as ugly as it is, she's right. I was ashamed of Garden Heights and everything in it. It seems stupid now, though. I can't change where I come from or what I've been through. So why should I be ashamed of what makes me me? That's like being ashamed of myself. Nah, fuck that. Maybe I was ashamed, I admit. But I'm not anymore. And Seven's not ashamed of you, your mama, or Lyric. He loves y'all, Kenya. So like I said, our brother, not just mine. Trust, I'm more than happy to share if it means getting him off my back. He can be a pain in the ass, can he? Girl, yes. We laugh together. As much as I've lost, I've gained some good stuff, too. Like Kenya. Yeah, all right, she says. I guess we can share him. Chop, chop, Star, Mama calls, clapping her hands as if that'll make me move faster. Still on her dictatorship, I swear. We've got work to do, Kenya. I got a bag and some gloves with your name on them if you want to help out. Kenya turns to me like, seriously? I can share her, too, I say. Matter of fact, please take her. We laugh and stand up. Kenya glances around at the rubble. More neighbors have joined in on cleaning up, and they form a line that moves trash out the store and into the trash cans on the curb. So what y'all gonna do now? Kenya asks. With the store, I mean. A car honks at us, and the driver yells out to let us know he has our back. The answer comes easily. We'll rebuild. Once upon a time, there was a hazel-eyed boy with dimples. I called him Khalil. The world called him a thug. He lived, but not nearly long enough. And for the rest of my life, I'll remember how he died. Fairy tale? No. But I'm not giving up on a better ending. It would be easy to quit if it was just about me, Khalil, that night, and that cop. It's about way more than that, though. It's about Seven, Sekani, Kenya, Devante. It's also about Oscar, Ayana, Trayvon, Rakia, Michael, Eric, Tamir, John, Ezel, Sandra, Freddie, Alton, Philando. It's even about that little boy in 1955, who nobody recognized at first. Emmett. The messed up part? There are so many more. Yet I think it'll change one day. How? I don't know. When? I definitely don't know. Why? Because there will always be someone ready to fight. Maybe it's my turn. Others are fighting too. Even in the garden, where sometimes it feels like there's not a lot worth fighting for. People are realizing and shouting and marching and demanding. They're not forgetting. I think that's the most important part. Khalil, I'll never forget. I'll never give up. I'll never be quiet. I promise.
Ain't we lucky we got 'em? Goodbye.
Context of white supremacy. Shout to Ned the Wino. Thank God we made it, persevered. Woohoo! Worst book we've ever read. On the book club,
And I remembered my comment from Jay in St. Louis, where he was saying they made it seem like some sort of horror movie. Like, oh my God, the car has broken down and we're stuck in the Negro side of town. It reminded me of the interview that Miss Thomas did previously, where she said she went to, in Mississippi, she went to a predominantly white college. And she was, I guess it was three other whites, three other Haleys, we'll say. I think that's the way she described it. They were driving and they were like, ooh, avoid, you know, the Negro part of town. They didn't say Negro. And Angie Thomas, she said, well, that's where I live. And she said that the whole car went silent. And I mentioned this moment before where I said, man, if I was any of those whites who was in the vehicle, if I read this book, I'd be saying, man, I want an apology right now, because we follow logic. We have the same opinion that you have. And after reading your book, if that's the way people behave over there, the characters didn't want to live there and I didn't want to be there either. I want an apology right now. That's what I would be saying if, you know, I was one of them. I said that before and came to mind again. If you would like to share a concluding thought, the number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. We are all done, so the time remaining, if you have a thought, if you would like to answer any of the questions that were presented, why black people who read this book adore it so much. Feel free if you have any other thoughts or questions. Let's see. We'll get our caller at 7656. I don't think we heard from you at all. Did you have commentary?
Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm glad it's over. It is pretty bad. I have to take back my comment. I said a few weeks ago that the book was well written. The more I heard it, the worse it got. I think last week I fell asleep. I was like, this is really not that serious. I can, I guess, take a nap. But I guess something to me that's constructive as someone who may, you know, I teach it, I may encounter young people who have read this book. I can be ready to deal with them when they see me, because I deal with mostly people right now who don't look like me, who are white. And they see me and think that I come from this environment. I have to, you know, brace myself and be ready for that. And then also, I think in the last discussion part, you talked about a young person who said that, you know, they like, people would like this book because they think this is how people live. And I can kind of say, not, of course, this happened way before this book, that people do believe like that. I taught one time, and this was a young black woman, and she asked me, I was also younger at that time. I told her I was from New York, and she asked me if I knew John Gotti. I don't know how many rap albums she had listened to before then, but all these black people or whatever knew John Gotti, or we just all hung out together. I'm like, okay, she doesn't know that John Gotti doesn't like black people. You know, she just did not know that. And so I was just like, no, I was a Girl Scout, because I was, and I just, that kind of shocked me. So, yes, this book is dangerous. Just like visuals and videos and all that are dangerous, because people who are not in those environments, they believe that all of black people or of a group, all of one type of people do live in that environment, and you have to be ready to deal with that, because this is what they will be coming to you with. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Appreciate that. Ivy, if you had commentary, you should be with us.
Thanks, Gus, and greetings to you and greetings to all the callers and listeners online. I'm just listening for now.
Yes, ma'am. Appreciate that. Any of the other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Caller at 9845. 9845, if you have commentary.
Hello, Gus. I have listened to all eight parts of this terrible book, and the only thing I can relate it to is the movie Belly, in that it mashed together every movie, every story, just it was like a hodgepodge of stereotypes all mixed into one. All the white commentators and also black commentators saying this is true to life, it would lead you to believe that every black female is raised in a ghetto, family has very few values. Like, I was just surprised at how the parents are portrayed in this book, being as though the parents in the book would be around my age group, how little guidance they gave their daughter in regards to white supremacy, racism, and even how to carry herself in the world. I found the character of the grandmother to be tacky with her swirler stories. I believe that this female author follows a pattern of overweight black women with self-esteem issues wishing for a white man. Like, I really did feel like it was selling interracial relationships to young black females, because there were no, like, really positive black males of the same age group. I found it hard to believe that even in her neighborhood, there were no black males who were doing well in school, who she found attractive. It was just wrong. It frustrated me, but I got through it. I wouldn't recommend this to anyone, and I think it's horrific that they had this as a required reading in school. It has very little literary value, and how it portrays current events is deplorable. That's all I had to say.
Got through it. I hate it when you get through to the end of a book, and that's the concluding feeling, like, I got through it. Oh, it was great. I can't wait to find something else from this author. And, oh, my gosh, I learned so much. And, oh, I got a retina. Woo! I got through it. That's, woo! Sometimes.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir, retired firefighter.
Yes, sir. I was just thinking, modern day version of The Color Purple. It kind of like circulates in my head. Also, the mechanics of of protesting, quote unquote, the word activism, very broad terms, and the attempt to counter racism, white supremacy, having broad terms like that is like caution at best. You know, I mean, it's almost like a cliche. You know, when I'm thinking about the mechanics of activism, it seems to, I mean, of a protest, it seems to be, for the most part, symbolic, shouting. They're being very emotional. I'm wondering who, when a person is quote unquote protesting, who are they talking to? The people who are in power, who count, they already know on what you're angry about. Everybody else that may be around in the crowd that is patting you on the back and cheering you on, I guess is a pet rally for those people, I guess. I'm saying that from a standpoint of, from a person that actually was doing that. You know, it really doesn't make any sense when it comes down to it. That's all I have to say. There wasn't any solution, anything that could be derived, unless somebody needs to tell me. There's no type of idea towards a solution to whatever problem she was talking about. The central problem in the book as far as unless somebody can tell me different, was racism, white supremacy, an act in the terms of an act where a white male killed, murdered a black male. And this book went all through everything and didn't really address that to the point to whereas, you know, some kind of idea of solving the problem never did come up, unless somebody can tell me different. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
I thought the central problem in the book was black people not snitching, but I'm ignorant. Maybe I missed something.
I'll be hurt.
Thomas in New York.
Yes, Gus. Thank you for taking my call. Good to hear from everyone. Belly was a great analogy. Just throwing together, just put a bunch of cliches and stereotypes in a movie and shot it like a video. In this book, I think the book does much more damage than the actual movie will do, because the movie would just be another, how many movies are we going to see like that in our lifetime? Another hood flick. I mean, so that we've become immune to that. But to actually read hood flicks is a new genre. And I just think this was done in such a tacky way because it was done by white people, not black people, in my opinion. Chris is grounded, but whites, to me, they always get grounded. Black people usually get put on punishment. You know, I think they were more afraid that they were going to get punished. That's why they didn't want to call home right away. Seven and Star were in the father's store, like, hey, man, we better be calling from this number so this number comes up. It was more of a punishment thing. Chris, the whole night, I mean, he was cool. He wasn't thinking about his parents. I mean, he knew what he was going to lose his phone for a week, or he couldn't watch television, or have his butler tie his tie for him in the morning. So, the only way they get black people's book to get to a bestsellers list, and when you saw a bestsellers list for books, there was a president that said, hey, you want to hide something from black people, you put it in a book. So we're not the number one consumers of books. The only way a book gets to the bestsellers list is it had a heavy promotional campaign that was directed toward white people. So even though this book is being dispersed in the black community to our youth, this book was written for white people. It was another book we read that was a bestseller, I believe, Gus. So wasn't that Ta-Nehisi Coates book a bestseller?
Oh, yeah. Hated that one, too.
Yeah, another. I'm sorry. Go ahead, brother. Sorry.
I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Oh, no. I was just saying his book was a bestseller. I didn't like that book either. But at least it was way more constructive than this book. Black Lives Matter. This is the book for Black Lives Matter. That's Antifa's mantra. Antifa is identify as three groups: the white feminists, the white LGBT, and the white Jews. And that's Antifa. And when you look at Charlottesville, what are the white Antifa people yelling? Black Lives Matter, which I thought was very strange. Haley. Haley is just like Chris. They're both racist. So this is why this book is a bestseller. Because this book appeals to white people because white's number one weapon is deception. And their number one deception is to keep us under the perception that there are white people that are not racist. As long as they have that going, their system works perfectly. Any media that black people put out where they could put a black face on and say they put it out, that keeps us in that perspective. That keeps them in that perspective, that keeps them thinking that we're in the perspective that they're good white people, is going to be heavily promoted. I don't care if it's music, movies, and now books. And that's all I had to say, Gus. Thank you.
Appreciate that, Thomas in New York. Other folks dial in that we've
missed or if you have additional comments you want to get in, we are all done. Angie Thomas, allegedly, author of The Hate U Give. We have a Red in Nevada. Do you have commentary?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for allowing me to share again. This is Red in Ohio. I do have the word guide with me. I couldn't find like Earning Your Stripes. Maybe I overlooked it, but I couldn't find anything basically to that reference. But going on to the book, just like everyone else's sentiment, basically, you know, it's definitely, I feel like it is definitely written for, like what Thomas in New York said, for, I guess, maybe like Antifa or what I was thinking, you know, the quote unquote liberals, to where these are the white people who pretend like they want justice, but in all actuality, these are the same ones who will gentrify a neighborhood. And I know there was like back on one of the compensatory call-ins would gentrify the neighborhood and then want to change the school system and everything like that. So they really don't care. And just like Gus was saying about, because I did actually end up going back in the archives and listening to the Turner Diaries. I thought it was funny. I laughed a lot during, especially like the voices that were made, and it kind of, even like the voices that were performed during that reading is kind of similar to the voices in this, you know, just the really over stereotype voices of the characters. But it does kind of remind me of how, like, back in the Turner Diaries, there was a family who allowed their daughter to go to a school, and the daughter, the white daughter, was basically being sexually terrorized by the black principal, and they were allowing the daughter to basically get raped. And I kind of feel like maybe that type of, like, from the side of a self-identified racist, I think that they would probably think that that type of white person would probably read this book, and probably the reason why it's on the bestsellers list. But then just throughout the book, just her refusal to, Star's refusal to lose Chris or Haley, you know, really not, these people really weren't adding anything to her life other than, you know, just the real worship of whiteness. Especially Haley, I know that, I think it might have been last week where, and I think something in this week as well, where it's like, you know what, I really, you know, don't want to be mad at her. I feel like I should forgive her. It's not, you know, she just basically said that one thing, but it's kind of like throughout her whole actions of the book. And I guess I was wrong with the other white girl who they briefly mentioned, I thought was going to take the place of Haley, the one who knew like the black handshake, or I think she laid her head on her shoulder in the cafeteria one time, and she knew Seven, that same white girl. I thought that she was going to replace Haley, but of course you cannot, you know, have somebody who is not as racist replacing a true racist. No, you have to still continuously fight for the love of these races. You know, just the Chris being so perfect, Chris being, you know, so close to black, but he's, the good thing about it is that he's not black and also wealthy. But I definitely feel like this is definitely a horrible book for any child to have to read. And the last part, it's just this whole one day thing, you know, well, one day these things will work out, but no one has the answers. So how is this the book of Black Lives Matter, other than, you know, just the other commentary that I made? But it's like, how is this, you know, constructive? You know, we'll never forget Khalil, and you'll never give up or whatever, but you kind of are not really, you don't really care. You kind of, throughout the book, she's, when she was at the, was she was at some restaurant. I don't know if it was the Waffle House or something like that, but I'm thinking about the Waffle House because of current events that's happened. But, you know, when she was at some restaurant after prom, she was, you know, happy that she forgot about Khalil and forgot about Natasha. So at one point you're glad that you're forgetting because Chris constantly gives you this sense of normalcy. But then, you know, you're saying you won't forget. And then how they kind of, you know, I think it was kind of tacky how they kind of added in, you know, some of the more quote unquote popular or prominent victims of racist terrorism at, you know, towards the end of the book. but nothing has really been done. Whites aren't really doing anything. So, again, I'm glad we got through the book as well. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Hello, Gus, may I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I realized what it was about the parents that truly burned me up. I don't understand why, after this happened, they did not get her psychological counseling, and also why they kept her in school. I'm quite sure if they would have been proactive and called the school and said, hey, my daughter's been the victim of something very traumatic. We need to get all her lessons and everything sent home with her for the duration, especially when they saw that it was becoming a national thing or even highly publicized locally. I don't understand why they would allow someone with an activist agenda to approach their daughter for representation instead of getting their own lawyer, especially with how knowing how cases in the past went. It just seemed like total dereliction on the side and behalf of the parents. And the father, Maverick, that whole racist trope of black men being the ex-con who turns his life around but still wants to keep it real and in the streets, and it was tacky. Like, I couldn't see how a self-respecting black woman who is a product of a black father could have written a book like this. I mean, and yes, to the point that you have made and other callers have made, the father had no power at all. He was almost like the fourth child in this book. It was pretty bad. Like, I just felt like the parents, the way they were portrayed, just wholly and totally dropped the ball. And where was the constant coaching from the parents about what to expect when you do attend a white high school? Like, it shouldn't, the mother, I understand you have to let your children make their own decisions, but it would seem as though if when the parents saw that type of behavior toward their daughter from the character Haley, that should have been something that was addressed, like, way before any of this occurred. That's all I had to say.
Appreciate your commentary. With regards to the school aspect, which I do think is really important, I think there is a portion very early on in the book where Star and her mother have a very explicit conversation. In this sense, I mean explicit, mean a very direct conversation about school. And the mom says that she wants her to go to school. Remember, at this time, they're in Garden Heights, so they're in the Negro part of town. You know, people are shooting every day. Somebody is shooting in the house, and black people are being shot and killed, you know, every time someone flushes the toilet. So the mom says, we want you to go to school. It's normal. It'll be good for you to just get, and again, normal is attached to being in the presence of whites consistently. So I remember that very beginning of the text, that there was direct dialogue about that and why. No, they felt that the counseling, the healing environment for her to be in would be whites at the school.
Yeah, it just felt like, let's ignore the problem and go on about our lives. And nowhere in the text was her PTSD or ongoing trauma addressed. And it felt like the character was projecting a lot of hopes and dreams on the white savior character, which was Chris, because he became her normal. And with that constantly being said in the book, my brain computer read it as white is normal, white is normal, white is normal. Black is abnormal. So because everything that was happening on the black side was just, I mean, having a half brother by a prostitute, beating people up for snitching and stealing money. Everybody's involved in some type of, on some level, in drug sales. I mean, it was just ridiculous.
system of white supremacy. Well, wanted to make sure I also read it was not the Waffle House. They had their flapjacks. The best night of her life, where she didn't think at all about any of the dead niggers, was at IHOP, not Waffle House. Not that that makes a big deal. Did we have any other folks who had not commented at all? The previous caller, excellent points, I thought, as well. Dokken, no emphasis on black mental health for this black child, none at all. And I thought the emphasis on white as normal and perfect, I talked about that last week. That's why even that scene in the uprising where they're pouring milk on their faces, even then, white is healing. White is replenishing, normalizing. Yes, to get us back to normal. No matter what the situation is, white gets us back to normal. Any other folks have comments?
I'll be heard. Go ahead.
Thank you. Man, a lot of thoughts. I'm glad that you guys are bringing up the milk thing, because a comparison that I can't get out of my mind that came up previously was the glorification of the golden, I believe it was the golden Oreos, and the demonization of the black ones. You know, just another example of glorifying that which is lighter versus that which is darker. And speaking of, you know, bad food, the as you always emphasize, Gus, the author, alleged author, is obese herself. And so that just reinforces all of the greed and just lack of care for health. And they can parade this alleged author around, this obese person that they can go and they can reference for this book. And I think that also, I don't put it past these races that it was intentional to put all of this food and this greed and this gluttony, knowing that the alleged author is obese, that they could have been also trying to insult her personally for her weight and things of that nature. Another thing was, I'll say about Chris. I'll tell you, Gus, like, I am so grateful for this program, because I witnessed a male today, a white male, who I accidentally friended. I didn't even know he was white. And he's one of those, he has a personality that is like Chris, where he plays the down role as the down, you know, white person, you know, who's down with black people, and he tries to talk like us and all that stuff, and he follows supposedly Nelly Fuller and things like that. And the things that I noticed on his Facebook page and the things that he promotes that the government up top, just the rich white people, so-called elites, are the problem, rather than all other white people as well, just your so-called average white person. Like, one thing I noticed about him is that once you gain a group of people's trust, which he has gained black people's trust, and these so-called down types, these Eminem types, they have gained our trust. And I noticed that he has a lot of Facebook friends, you know, that are black. Once you do that, you can guide the narrative and you can say whatever you want. And by him being a white person, he's not ignorant about racism. So he knows good and well that it is not just the people in Washington that are denying people jobs and health care and education and everything else, and murdering us and hanging us from trees and calling us nigger and everything else. But that's the way that he wants to portray what's going on and what's going on in reality, that it's really them. It's not like your average white person. And then he made a statement about he said to white people that if they hear other black people denigrating other black people, that they should tell those black people how they should redirect the conversation to white pathology and how white people are responsible for whatever it is the black people are complaining about with each other. And he says if you're not doing that, you're committing a functional act of white supremacy. Now, on the surface, that looks really good, but really what he is propagating is that white people don't know this, that white people don't know when they're practicing white supremacy. So it's like he's trying to tell everybody, hey, I'm trying to teach you white people, if you're doing this, you're practicing white supremacy, as if they don't know that. And they do know that. And they're not ignorant, and he's not either. And so I noticed that if it was not for this program, I would have trusted this man. I would have friended him, and I would have followed him and probably even worshipped him. And I noticed that he has just a lot of people's trust just from that. And it just kind of reminds me of this Chris guy, because he's a racist as well. Even though he's a character, he's a racist as well. If you're sitting up there making fun of names like Devontae, which I like that name, you're making fun of the names. I don't like the term making fun, but that's the best I can do right now. You're making fun of names of a group of people that you say you cool with, and you're teasing them or denigrating them in some kind of way. You're practicing racism. So this Chris guy, even though he's supposed to be this down person, he could just sit around you and just practice racism, and it's just cool, and he's still your normal because he's white and because he pretends to be down. And I'll leave it there for now. And I just want to say, Gus, thank you so much for this program. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
I got your back, Ivy. Thank you for your patience, Mr. Demery. Did you have commentary?
Oh, yes. Thanks. Thanks, Gus. That was part of my, nobody has anybody's back. You know, first of all, they hollering out in the book, you know, we got your back and all that. If you know anything about counter-racism, first thing you better realize is you put yourself out there on the list. Nobody's got your back. Nobody's got your back. Okay, what is the lawyer, Miss Ofer, what is her purpose? I thought about that, and it seems like she would have been better suited to have been the lawyer of Khalif's grandmother, the lady that was raising him, and maybe she could have negotiated some type of monetary. That seems to be the only thing that comes from killing of unarmed black men in the street, is the family can get some sort of monetary value, which, you know, how can you put a value on somebody's life? Unless I'm mistaken, she didn't even accompany Star doing the questioning in the prosecutor's meeting of the grand jury. I may be mistaken, but I mean, there's nothing for her to gain in representing Star. I don't understand why. Well, I mean, Star would need an attorney, you know, to help negotiate those meetings and all of that, but the book didn't focus on that. And then it gave reference to, I guess when she was talking about Haley, and then she said, she's sure she's racist, but that's okay. And that it's not okay. They're shitty people. And that would give the impression that, you know, if you're racist, you're just a shitty person. That's all. We can tolerate this, but see, it's giving, especially young minds that's impressionable, the impression that it's a small part of society of whites that are racist, and that the large part of the society of whites don't believe, you know, that way. That deception that I think Thomas was bringing up from New York, the deception that all whites or not racist comes into play. The pictures and the videos they were talking about her coming out in the newspaper, throwing stuff at the police, that's come up in recent events. They used those pictures and video tapes to later prosecute the participants in that, and they downplayed that like it was something historic, but I know when they had the disturbance in Baltimore, they went over those files and then identified those people and then pressed charge against them later. And everybody probably remember the mother that came out. Her son was throwing stuff at the police. She grabbed him and slapped him. And I guess grabbed him by the ear or whatever, drug him off. But, you know, that was lauded as, you know, good parenting when she shows up at the disturbance and beats her son down. And then when did the NOA ever sell oranges on the corner? I heard that. I don't know if they were talking about the Nation of Islam, you know, when Maverick said something about if he has to sell oranges on the corner. You know, that was tacky. And they talking about Khalif, but where were they when Khalif was struggling, hustling, trying to put $2 together, you know, to help his grandmother, you know. All this concern now, but Uncle Carlos, I guess, admitted him being a public servant and knowing the situation of Khalif, he did not do enough to help the young man out. Now I'll mute my line. Thank you, Gus. Thank you, Carl.
Got your back to Mr. Demery for.
I have additional commentary, Gus, if it's okay.
Well, let me get let me get the caller at 3637 first, because I don't think we heard them at all. 3637, did you have commentary?
Apologize for getting at y'all late here. I just got off work. I was able to wrap up the book with everybody. And hello, everyone. This is a caller from the 712. Thanks for letting me say something, Gus. And I'll be real brief here. The book was tacky, trashy, and terroristic to me, because the way they were treating the father, Maverick, I just didn't, that was horrible. It was really disgraceful. And I do agree with Gus or anybody else that said that this book could have been ghostwritten by some white people, one or more. And it really reminded me of, it's going to sound weird, but it reminded me of Belly. Well, I thought it was going to be like Belly. When I went back and watched Belly after I was gained more knowledge about white supremacy, I realized what a horrible movie that was. But they made you sit through that movie and you sat there and seen all types of degradation of humanity and everything. And at the end, it was supposed to be a message of morality or something at the end of that movie. And I thought this book was going to do that. But at the end of this book, I don't really know what the message was supposed to be with this book. It's very confusing. I'm glad that we read it, because if there's any young people in my family, that they would be required to read this book. I took notes, and I'm happy to, you know, just sit down and talk about the book with them before they even start reading it. So I appreciate you letting me say something, Gus, and good evening to everybody. Thank you.
Indeed. I just realized we are so ahead of the curve. This book is going to probably loiter on the New York Times young adult bestseller list for a long time, because it's going to get a nice boost when the movie comes out. So, and I suspect more people will read the book then. So you should. I said before, and I'm sticking to it, if you listened, we have people who said that they persevered, made it through. Write a review. I'll post it on my blog. Could be a good number of folks are interested in this book and might stumble upon this podcast or your review of the book. I'm going to write one myself, but you know, let's do something. We listened, we endured. We can at least write a few words. Doesn't have to be super long, but a few words about what we thought The Hate U Give. Let's see. Thomas in New York and retired firefighter. Let's get Thomas in New York first.
Absolutely. Thank you, Gus. And this book to me exudes the same problem I have with black movies, because we never win at the end. You're left with all that trauma and it's never resolved. You know, why couldn't Maverick have started a chain of stores, or why couldn't the cop had get charged with murder at the end? You know, our fictional art is always based off of non-fictional things. And from music to movies to hip-hop, you know, fictional narrative based off of non-fictional events. And we read another book with riots and uprisings that, in my opinion, was done right. And that was The Spook That Sat By The Door, because, you know, they got some retribution. You know, it was fictional, but, you know, they made things happen in that movie, I mean, in that book. And this book was just very stagnant. And the last thing I wanted to say was Maverick, in my opinion, he should have money. To me, this book is promoting that black people can't own black businesses and make money. This man owns a store in the black community. We all watch black, well, every other race of people come into our community and open stores and take all our money, and we know they make money. So why can't this man have money? It's just, I didn't like that about it either, and that was my last two things I had to say. Thank you, Gus.
In the system of racism, white supremacy, black people don't have communities. Very important piece of information. I think it's lost frequently. And I think if we could accept that that is true under the system of white supremacy, I think we would readjust some of our expectations. Retired firefighter?
Yes, sir. The cliche, I got your back. You know, in relating to the book, it seemed like every time that came up, it was some sort of very negative circumstance. In other words, I'm cleaning up the residue from my business being burned to the ground, which would dissipate half of my income to have to pay for my new home. And you're saying you got my back. Well, you didn't have my back before the building was burning down. You know, it seems to be under the system of racist white supremacy, the quote unquote story of our lives. You know, as far as they're concerned, totally useless cliche. I got your back. And also another reason why the book will be popular, because it does not really spurn or generate any counter-racist conversation. Now, it is talked about in the book directly and indirectly, but from what I gather from the book and the conversations on or the talk about racism, white supremacy, it made it seem that it's not a global system. It's a situation where every now and then a white person would come up and say something that's racist, or would actually act out physically as in murder a non-white person. But for the most part, you know, you have a whole lot of very nice white people like Chris, that sort of thing. Although, and I definitely didn't hear him as a rapist, you know, for sticking his finger in a non-white black person's vagina, as far as that concerned. But the book doesn't. I mean, I mentioned about the ending of it. Even from the standpoint of if you're dealing with nothing but non-white black people. And if you had to come up with the question, well, what if the book actually does it have any ideas for a solution to the problems that they were talking about, focusing on? that sort of thing. And there's nothing like that in the book, you know, as far as any solutions, any way to solve the many problems that was talked about in the book. So that would be something that white people would definitely promote and with their power circulate, because it is something that could very much confuse non-white young people, and that's what it's designed for. Thank you.
Gus, can I say something quick?
Let's hear it.
Okay, I just had one thing that I forgot. I think that the overall theme of this book is that black people are the biggest savages in the history of mankind, and they deserve anything that comes to them, whether it be one of them being murdered by racists or people posing as friends that are saying racist comments, whatever it might be, because to me, black savagery dominated this book, even over the so-called interracial relationship, which I do think that was like huge in the book. But I think black savagery totally dominated this book, from being shot on every page, on every other page, and just all kinds of other things, even if they had to, which they did, exaggerate the behaviors of just humans in general, let alone black people, and just adding a bunch of stuff that just doesn't even make any sense, and just to make everything all the more, their behavior all the more savage. So that's what I think was the point of this book. And it's the same story with every time we are murdered by racists, that we're going to redirect the situation or the conversation to black savagery. And I think that was the point of this book. Someone asked that question, like, what is the message of this book? I think that was the message of the book. And thanks, Gus. I'll meet my line.
We have appreciate that, Ivy. Do we have anybody else, since we're all done? Any final thoughts, remark?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
The final thing that I wanted to say, I was just thinking about it, actually, because, of course, this book just kind of ends with nothing. But I feel like one of the more important things is that with the whole reoccurring theme of the this sad relationship between Star and the racist Chris, it just seems like Star is basically like a phase for him as he grows and, you know, takes on, I'm assuming, what little we know about his racist parents. There's nothing that she'll be able to do to still kind of hold on to him. So I feel like that's something that's also important, that if black, young black females are being made to read this and thinking that there's going to be some type of happy ending between Star and Chris, you know, they're definitely not being told the end of the story with that. So I guess that was the only other thing that I wanted to add. Thank you.
Let me tell y'all about Black Chicks. I think might be a more realistic portrayal of quote unquote interracial relationships. Dr. Carolyn West, just a couple days ago. I did want to make sure we did our 3 hours. I didn't even read my notes for the second half. Maybe I don't need to. But I did want to make sure, we had three different references to Belly today. And I think even by the time that the third reference came up, she hadn't even heard the first two references. Now, I might be wrong. Maybe she did. But three separate references to Belly, which is very high on my list for worst films of all time. The only thing that I'm pleased about with that film is that I thankfully only had to endure sitting through about a half of, it's not worse than Precious. Yeah, it's not worse than Precious. Anyway, but I immediately, the first time I saw it, thought, oh my gosh, this is the worst thing I've ever seen. I don't even need to see the rest of it. But the movie being bad, I remember I spoke with Mr. Fuller, this was some years back, and he was saying that he wanted to support black projects. I think we were talking about black businesses. He was saying, you know, I wanted to support, but I didn't really want to see Superfly. I didn't really want to see Belly. I didn't really want to see these films and black people being portrayed like this. if this is what I'm going to support a black business, like, oh man, like, I don't know. I might have to be a coon because I am not feeling Belly. I am not feeling the hate they give. But that did remind me of a conversation with Mr. Fuller. I will look at my notes just to make sure I did not miss out on anything important for the last chapter. Haley should have been gone a long time ago. I said that, you know, before there was nothing in their relationship other than her being white. And she's not a quote unquote shitty ass person. I thought that was important. She's racist because you could, and particularly we're talking about young adults, 13-year-olds, 11-year-olds who already think that, you know, oh yeah, most white people aren't racist at all. Thinking that, oh, she's just inconsiderate or rude. Or mean-spirited, or immature, or whatever, fill in the blank, whatever the issue is. Not, she's racist, white supremacist. That's what it is. It's dangerous to be around her. Shouldn't have been around her to begin with. That's very, very different than just, she's a shitty-ass person. Thank goodness she did delete her, get rid of her. The scene in the new house, it says Mama flips the switches on the wall. One causes a grinding noise in the sink. Another turns the lights off and on. Too many switches, she mumbles. It is 2018. Are you telling me that you have black people mystified by a garbage disposal and a light switch? Worst book I have ever read in my life. I haven't read Precious. I didn't read the novel. Maybe that's worse. But this, nothing is close. Are you see? And even that you have apparently large numbers of black people who, I guess, read this. All of this, black people being named goon, none of this sticks out as being, wow, this seems kind of derogatory. This does not exactly make me feel good about black people reading this sort of text. Where she, right over, same page, Dad Maverick, check out the newspaper, check out Little Black Panther, reminded me of Bobby Hutton since they were just talking to him a couple weeks ago, 50th anniversary of his death. And it just seemed like a lot of kind of tacky, superficial references to the Black Panther Party, just outright disses in some cases. They called Huey P. Newton a crackhead before, and then even Mr. Lewis, when he's giving Maverick the store, he says, can we get some pictures of Dr. King up alongside Huey? No, he didn't even call him Huey. He called him Newey. Newey. N-E-W-E-Y. Whoever he was. I mean, wow. It's not Saturday. I mean, that's just like pissing on Huey Newton and the Black. And they did it repeatedly in the book. Why does that have to be done repeatedly in a book? Worst book I've ever read in my life, bar none. I will. Oh, she said Sakani. We got more of the snitching thing, and I thought that was important because she didn't say Sakani snitched. She said Sakani rats. Again, the comparison, black people are not humans. They're rodents, vermin. They were ants looting in the previous. I don't even need to say anymore. Anybody have anything else they need to get in before we're done?
Yeah, Gus. Can I bear it?
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to say that my wife is recuperating well, and we should be in litigation sometime in the summer, but she wanted to reiterate that we should do something about trying to keep this book out of the hands of the young people. And I said, it's a bestseller. You know, she still thinks that something should be done, and we should make some effort to try to, you know, bring some kind of conclusion to this. It shouldn't be in the schools, that's for sure. I'll mute my line.
Hey, I'm in agreement, but I mean, the worst is yet to come. I would think whatever hoopla has surrounded this book so far, wait until the movie is released. Oh, my. God, definitely not going to see that. If there are any Cows listeners, absolutely not. Gus is not doing a review. We're not doing a program on it. We did the book. Go back, press the rewind button, and you can apply it to the film. But yeah, I think it's going to be even worse when the movie comes out. I would just encourage we read it. You can share this. You can, you know, share your own opinion. I'm sure other people have written. I'm encouraging people to write reviews so that way you don't have to invest hours and hours listening to the podcast or listening to this god-awful book. You know, you can read if people want to write a review. That would be helpful or whatever. You can do a video. Blog, whatever you think would be helpful to, I think, just be truthful and accept, man, racists, they are going to weaponize and use this. Wow. I mean, they have already invested a lot in it and they got more to come. So accepting that that's true. Now, what can we do to counter that? That, I think, is our mission. And yeah, that's something to think about. just knowing that a lot of young people are probably going to have access to this book and or be required to do some flipping through the pages. Take one more comment. Anybody else? Last comment.
I'll add that I'm glad to hear what Mr. Demi Ford has said. Grateful for the update and much love to both of them and hope that their litigation goes well. And I wanted to quickly say that the goons, or somebody was named goons, that term comes from white people and it means a monster and all of that, so they try to, you know, credit us with those terms. We learn this stuff from white people, and good riddance to the racism you give. I'll leave my line.
Good riddance indeed. That was the best thing of the day. It was not the book that Mr. Demi Ford's wife is doing better. Bravo. Best thing of the day. Woof. Good riddance to the text. New book for next week. I sat around and I thought, well, I need something like cleansing for my palate to have to endure this. No, but the person who I guess they did kind of recommend, the black educator who recommended it, I'm glad we read it because I just had no idea this was being forced on black children. And, you know, this was the number one bestseller, New York Times Young Adult List. Glad we read it. Awful book. I was thinking what to follow up with. And we did have listener suggestions. I was thinking myself of what to read, you know, something good. It had to be something good. It didn't really matter what the book was, but it had to be something good. And I was looking at my top five, and other than Dr. Welsing, I put an asterisk there because she was on the program so many times that I feel like, you know, you kind of got to hear lots and lots from the author. So we put an asterisk next to that one. But looking at my top five, we have covered most of the books in my top five. I was looking at the exceptions. One glaring exception is Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. Now, I did say, hey, this is fiction, back-to-back fiction on the Cows. Like, wow, that's absurd. However, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man is amazing. It is all about racism. I think that's one of the few books we've talked about, like, repeatedly. We had Dr. Kevorkian on to talk about that book. I think he references that book every time he comes on the program. We had another professor who's written about Ellison repeatedly on to talk about that book. Listeners who have heard me mention the book and how much I adore this book, it's just amazing. Who've read it, I heard good commentary from them as well. This might even be one I'd be willing to make a deal. I listened to Invisible Man. I have the audiobook. I listened to it last week just to see, like, is this worth being on the Cows? And I listened just to see if I could listen to 30 minutes of it. And I ended up listening to about 2 hours of the text. And I've read Invisible Man, like, oh, man, at least 3 times, more than that. The deal I'd be willing to make, we can give it a trial run for next week. I would almost be willing to take unanimous. I think Invisible, it's in my top five. I would be willing to take unanimous. If we have one person who says, this sucks, I don't like it, we should do something more constructive, we can stop and do something else, which I don't think we've done before on the book club, but I would be willing to make that deal. Invisible Man is that great. And it doesn't matter to me either way because I've already read the book. So even if we don't want to proceed, no big deal. And if someone does not, if we do have people or multiple folks who say they're not feeling it, you should have an alternate book at the ready to suggest, preferably that already has an audiobook, because I do not feel like reading Still Stressed from the Flood. So we'll start Invisible Man next Friday, Ralph Ellison, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. That should be an easy one, widespread. That also is a book that white people like a lot. It gets recommended. I just said Dr. Martin Kevorkian, he references it about every time he comes on the program. That would be great. Now, what is so different about these two works of fiction that white people adore that were written about 75 years apart, approximately? Be great to think on for next week. Thanks for everyone tuning in. Hope it was constructive, even though the book was horrid. We'll be here tomorrow for the compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Feel free to drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, if you have questions, gripes, complaints. I cannot imagine anyone having problems getting their hand on Invisible Man, but I guess you can let me know about that too. But the library should have like bunches of copies of Invisible Man. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Let's do everything that we possibly can to keep our brain computers safe, healthy, so that we can think of solutions, new concepts to solve the problem. Racism, white supremacy. I know it's getting warm, springtime, it's almost May. Have fun, just stay codified if you're going to be out and about. If you're going to be in a vehicle, you want to be sober and buckled up every time, driver or passenger. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with the 115s of the world, badge or no. That's it, Creator. We ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Context of white supremacy signing out. Cows has all of our listeners back. Cows signing out.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.